Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Now his fame and his wealth began to work for him. Even as he was led away in handcuffs, a cavalry of lawyers was saddling up for the rescue. The biggest names in defense rode into town, attracted by his fame and possibly his $10 million fortune. First, they strung up a free phone hotline to solicit any evidence on his behalf.
If you have any information or evidence regarding the O.J. Simpson case, press 2 now. If you are an expert in the field relating to the O.J. Simpson case and would like to offer your services, press 3 now.
If you have millions of dollars, the American legal system really can offer better odds at proving your innocence. You can buy, as Simpson has, a dream team to defend you, but you can never buy a jury. Nevertheless, American justice itself is on trial in the Simpson case, for as the hysteria subsides, the nation will eventually demand clear and unequivocal evidence that neither the accused's money, nor fame, nor image is going to lead to the wrong verdict.
At this time, do you wish to enter a plea guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
O.J. will spend at least $4 million fighting to prove his innocence, but it's not so much what O.J. Simpson is buying as what many fellow black suspects can't buy that makes this case so controversial.
What faces the average black defendant in a murder case?
In a sense, the whole world is against him right from the beginning. Instead of being like O.J. Simpson in that people don't want to believe that he's guilty, everybody wants to believe that he's guilty and does believe that he's guilty. But the most serious thing that affects him is that he has, when he's on trial for his life, he has no champion. He doesn't get to an adequate lawyer to do any of these things that have been done for O.J. Simpson, not one of them. And that's so that there's a sense, I keep wondering what these men in prison think as they watch the Simpson trial.
San Quentin Prison, death row for some 300 convicted murderers, many of them black. I went to visit three of them, all angry that O.J. Simpson has already been granted immunity from the death sentence if found guilty. Multiple murder is a capital offense in California. Inside one of the toughest prisons in America, they contemplate a justice system they believe is hand-tailored for the rich. Convicted men argue that indifferent lawyers, less consultation time, and less investigative work make their chances so much worse.
Is this where you have your visits normally, Terry? To put it at its simplest, if you are poor and a minority in the United States, you just don't get the kind of justice that Simpson is getting. Is that what you're saying?
If you're poor, period, in this country, you don't get that type of representation.
Why not? Is it just a shortage of money?
No, the system moves in a certain way. And if you can't shake that way up, if you can't... The fallacy about being proven guilty or being innocent until proven guilty, it just doesn't exist. There's a basic misconception that where there is smoke, there is fire. And the average, not all, but the average 12 jurors in this country, if you're sitting in the defendant chair, you are guilty. Money can help buy you that assumption of innocence. And that's what O.J. has going for him.
Were you surprised when the district attorney decided not to ask for the death penalty for Simpson?
I was not surprised that he did not ask for it in that particular case.
Why?
because it would have brought to the forefront the whole issue of the death penalty in those type of cases. And people would have said, well, you know, O.J. Simpson's friends in Hollywood and places like that, these people that are normally used by the state to promote the death penalty, many of them would have came out against it simply because O.J. Simpson was their friend.
Do you need money to get justice?
Pointedly, I think yes. Seriously. There is a two-headed sword in the justice in the criminal courts that I can understand here in California. If you have money, certain investigative services, certain experts are available to you that are not available to you if you don't have the funds to pay for them.
How would it have affected your case?
I think that the argument in the areas of the lack of evidence that was in my case at the time, it probably would have ended in a much different situation. I don't think that I would be on death row right now.
Really?
Absolutely.
The truth is, the justice system is geared to speedy trials for the poor. Compromise deals cost less and don't drain the system of time and staff. That's why the rich benefit.
What would happen if every accused were able to do what O.J. Simpson has done?
The system would totally collapse. The rights are there, but if everybody could take advantage of them, we don't have enough judges, enough courthouses, enough jails, enough police to do that.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, January 7, 2021. So I have been told. This is our first book club of the so-called new year. Hopefully constructive. As we try to move forward and get something from learning, I think it's still reading more important than watching television, even in the new year. This is Jeffrey Toobin's The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. This is our seventh study session, picking up on Chapter 11, The Dream Team. So this will break down all of the many faces who were a part of the O.J. Simpson defense. There's a slight difference between the book we are reading and the FX series that came out in 2016 that is based on this book. Toobin was a consultant for that series as well. For the most part, they are in lockstep, like almost exactly the same. Some of the episode titles from that series are the same titles from the book. So, and Toobin, as I said, was a consultant, so no surprise that it's pretty much in sync, but there are some differences. So for the series, the chapter that we're starting with today is actually episode 3. So it's earlier in the TV series. It's just slightly out of order where they would have already gone over all of this, but either way, mostly the same, generally covered in the TV program. We are picking up. Last week they selected the entire 12-person jury for the trial, even though people were booted, so it changed around a little bit. But mostly black, mostly female, mostly black females on this jury as we move forward. So this is covering like the nebulous month or few months before the actual trial started in early 1995. For the audio segment that we heard today, that was from the BBC documentary, The Mr. Nice Guy Murders. This is from the 1994 Panorama series examining the case. So you heard a white woman, Professor Barbara Babcock. She was talking about how for normal victims of white supremacy, black males, should you be charged with killing a white woman or any other crimes, you are not going to have all of the names that we hear about today, F. Lee Bailey and Barry Sheck and all these folks lining up to come and help you out and see if they can find some DNA evidence to exonerate you. Not going to happen. And they followed that up speaking with a number of black males who had been convicted of a number of crimes in San Quentin, California. Terry Beemore, Oscar Gates, Cedric Harrison. Those were the black males that you were hearing from talking about the extraordinary differences between their situation being convicted of a crime and Mr. Simpson. Him automatically were not pursuing the death penalty and all the rest. We will go ahead and get started. Just one thing I'll kind of share. Right while all of this is happening in late 1994, the Colin Ferguson Long Island Railroad shooting trial had been going on. That is a whole nother incident worthy of a whole nother book club study session and just wow. But on the opposite coast in New York, even though the Long Island Railroad shootings, that happened in 1993, the trial not until 94, but even that got overshadowed by the O.J. Simpson trial, but just extraordinary times in this part of the world, 1994. Anyway, we will get started. Jeffrey Toobin, Context of White Supremacy, The Run of His Life, audio segment 1.
Chapter 11. The Dream Team. John Tobin was 72 years old and ailing in 1960, but his reputation as a criminal defense lawyer still towered in Massachusetts. That year, as was customary, Tobin was retained in the headline murder case of the day, the killing of Betty Edgerly, a Lowell housewife. Her body had been scooped out of the Merrimack River in pieces, and her grisly demise had given the crime its nickname, the Torso Murder. Her husband, George, was charged with the crime. The key evidence against George involved a polygraph examination, and John Tobin knew nothing about the new and evolving science of lie detection. He asked around for an expert, and all he could come up with was the name of a recent law school graduate by the name of Francis Lee Bailey. Bailey was just 27 years old at the time, the son of a struggling advertising man and a nursery school teacher. His parents had sent him to prep school and then on scholarship to Harvard, where he drifted on gentlemen's seas until the United States Navy summoned him for active duty. Bailey trained as a fighter pilot and developed a lifelong obsession with flying and owning his own planes. As a secondary assignment, Bailey joined his unit's legal office, which transformed his life even more than flight school. He worked as a sort of jack-of-all-trades in the military justice system, trading roles as prosecutor, defense lawyer, investigator, and judge. Bailey developed a specialty in the use of the polygraph, a machine that has always been more favored in the military than in civilian life. When he went to Boston University for law school, Bailey refined his expertise with the polygraph when he moonlighted as an investigator for lawyers preparing for trials. He was still running his little investigation business when he passed the bar examination in November 1960, just a few weeks before he heard from John Tobin. Tobin confided to the young lawyer that he had been snookered. Polygraph results were generally inadmissible in criminal trials, but Tobin had blundered into allowing the jury to hear that his client had flunked a test administered by a novice examiner. It looked like the entire case would come down to whether the defense could discredit Augustine Lawler, a local pharmacist who had volunteered his polygraphy services to the police. Tobin was tired and sick, and after speaking to Bailey briefly about the new technology, he had a question for the young lawyer. "Lee," he said, "would you be willing to come into the case to cross-examine this guy, Lawler? I don't think there's another lawyer in Massachusetts who would recognize a lie detector if you dropped one on him. I think you could help us. F. Lee Bailey had never before set foot in a courtroom, but he jumped at the chance. Over the years, Bailey has written a great deal about his own career and about criminal law generally. His specialty, in both theory and practice, has been the art of cross-examination. His first law is a simple one. The cross-examiner's first task is to pin down all that the witness claims to know about the subject and all that he says he doesn't know, Bailey has written. Until a witness is firmly committed to a definite statement or position, he can parry a question or sidestep it with some kind of explanation. Bailey's task, thus, was to pin down Lawler, the polygrapher. The young lawyer brought a whole stack of books about the polygraph to the courtroom and tried to get Lawler to concede that one of them was authoritative, which would allow Bailey to show how this beginner had violated the book's commands. Lawler was wise to this game and would not vouch for any of the books, but Bailey, meticulously prepared, had also found the instruction manual for the polygraph machine that Lawler used, and the witness, trapped, had to admit that the manual did describe the appropriate procedures. Bailey promptly went on to show the jury how the witness had violated many of the manual's commands. The weight of Lawler's testimony crumbled. One successful cross-examination does not make a career, but in fitting storybook manner, the elderly Tobin suffered a seizure shortly before final arguments in the Edgerly case. From his sickbed, he asked Bailey to give the summation. Bailey did, of course, and then went to a neighboring tavern to await the verdict. "I kept fidgeting and drinking scotch," he wrote of the scene. "I had done little boozing in the service, and I couldn't afford liquor while I was in law school, but I drank like 14 fishes while the Edgerly jury deliberated. Interestingly enough, the liquor had little effect on me. Perhaps it has something to do with tension, or with adrenaline. All I know is that most trial lawyers drink, and the good ones can hold their booze." The verdict came back in less than a day. Not guilty. A career and a legend was launched. When Bailey told the story of the Edgerly case, as he has done in a pair of memoirs and hundreds of conversations, he lingered on his favorite part, his humiliation of the hapless Lawler. Bailey was only 61 during the Simpson trial, but his heavily lidded eyes, which bore the toll of decades of drink and overwork, twinkled as he told of Lawler's abject surrender. Bailey didn't spend much time worrying about whether George Edgerly actually murdered his wife. That was not Bailey's concern. Proximity to murder can harden a conscience, and so it is with Lee Bailey. He is a consummately cynical man, with an eye only for the bottom line, legal and financial. The guilt or innocence of his clients means little to him. He once wrote, "I prefer cases that offer whopping fees and/or professional challenge." Regularly and rancorously, Bailey has rotated law partners and wives. He has been married 4 times. For all his stormy and dissolute personal life, insatiable ego, and pervasive misanthropism, one fact stands out about Bailey. He invented the contemporary practice of criminal defense law. Prior to his emergence into public view in the 1960s, criminal defense had been a vaguely disreputable and mostly unprofitable backwater of the legal profession. Bailey changed that. First, he understood the news media and how to manipulate the press for his ends. If Bailey did not invent the impromptu press conference on the courthouse steps, he made the practice his own. He recognized the general importance of appearance. His clothes were tailor-made, and so were his elevator shoes. His lust for the spotlight even led him into questionable ethical territory when, on some cases, he accepted as part of his fee the right to write a book about his work on a case. Bailey also engaged in the kind of exhaustive preparation for cases that, before him, had been the practice of only the best lawyers in the biggest firms. Bailey came of age when the term superstar first came into vogue, and he was, without question, the first legal superstar. Within a half dozen years of his debut in the Edgerly case, he had an estate south of Boston and a helicopter for commuting to work. Before he was 40 years old, he boasted that he had charged a client $1 million. There was no shortage of clients, at any price. 2 days after Bailey's first anniversary as a member of the bar, he met Dr. Samuel Shepherd, an osteopath from the Cleveland suburbs who had been charged, like Edgerly, with murdering his wife. It was an even more sensational case, the inspiration for the television series The Fugitive. And Bailey spent half a decade winning Shepherd his freedom. Along the way, Bailey traveled on both the high and low roads, as would be his custom. To publicize his attempt to give Shepherd a polygraph test in prison, Bailey went on The Mike Douglas Show and demonstrated the technique on a comedian. In a more exalted setting, the United States Supreme Court, Bailey successfully argued that Shepherd's original conviction should be thrown out because of excessive pretrial publicity. While Shepherd's case was moving through the system, Bailey also represented Albert DeSalvo, the admitted Boston Strangler. The court in the DeSalvo case rejected Bailey's argument that DeSalvo should be committed to a mental hospital rather than a prison. DeSalvo was eventually murdered in prison in 1973. Bailey also won an acquittal for Dr. Carl Coppolino when he was charged with poisoning his lover's husband in New Jersey. But even Bailey couldn't help this doctor when he was charged with and convicted of poisoning his wife in Florida. Bailey's lust for the spotlight and cash led him astray in the years after his initial fame. In 1973, he was indicted in a federal mail fraud conspiracy case in Florida, along with his former client, Glenn Turner, whose motivational business, known variously as Dare to Be Great and Coscott Interplanetary, turned out to be little more than a Ponzi scheme. Characteristically, Bailey was tempted into working with Turner because the entrepreneur promised the lawyer a new Learjet as his fee. Thanks to the efforts of his lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, Bailey managed to have the case against him dismissed. After the Turner fiasco, Bailey represented Patricia Hearst, the newspaper heiress, in the case that arose out of her kidnapping by the Symbionese Liberation Army. Bailey's performance was much criticized, and Hearst was convicted of bank robbery. In 1982, Bailey was again charged with a crime, drunk driving, and his friend Robert Shapiro successfully represented him at his San Francisco trial. Not coincidentally, the abuse of alcohol has been a leitmotif of Bailey's professional life. The first line of Bailey's 1975 memoir reads, "Heavy trials make me thirsty." He has long dismissed friends' advice to cut back. "It's my fuel," Bailey has said. For all his faults and traumas, Bailey continued to try cases throughout the 1980s and 1990s, and for the most part, try them very well. Indeed, of all the lawyers on either side of the Simpson case, Bailey not only had the most experience trying murder cases, he had conducted the most recent murder trial as well. In March 1994, Bailey won an acquittal for one Paul Tanso, charged with a double murder in Boston's North End. Bailey's bravura cross-examination of Tanso's ostensible accomplice marked the turning point in the case. His trademark had not changed since John Tobin summoned him from obscurity almost 40 years earlier. For all his fame, Bailey has never been an especially theatrical courtroom performer. He is, rather, a master of preparation. Endlessly, meticulously, remorselessly, Bailey investigates the facts, or hires those who do. Immediately after he was retained by O.J. Simpson, the week after the murders, Shapiro called Bailey. He treated Bailey with a deference befitting the elder lawyer's exalted history as a defense attorney. But there were tensions from the outset, too. Shapiro couldn't help but enjoy the change in status between them. 12 years earlier, Bailey had favored Shapiro with the assignment of defending him in the drunk driving case. Now Shapiro had the kind of case that once would have gone to Bailey as a matter of course. When Bailey appeared on the Simpson case's quasi-official forum, Larry King Live, on June 24th, to announce that he had joined the defense team, his choice of words reflected the possibility of future trouble between him and Shapiro. "We are close friends," Bailey said of Shapiro. "I'm the godfather of Bob's oldest child. I also want to make perfectly plain the fact that he is the lead counsel in this case, and I am consulting with him." King asked why Bailey had waited to announce that he was part of the defense team. "Simply because my recommendation, with all the sniping that someone has been sponsoring, saying Bob Shapiro couldn't handle this case, which I think is silly because when I was in trouble, I hired him, and he won my case. And he is the only lawyer in the country allowed to have my name on his letterhead. And I thought it would be best to let the case proceed down the road a little bit until it was firmly established that he had control. He has. He's handled it brilliantly." In fact, there had been very little sniping about Shapiro's abilities until Bailey raised the issue on the air that night. As for the purported drama about when to make Bailey's announcement, Bailey invented that issue as well. His entire presentation had the air of a man protesting too much. By defending Shapiro, Bailey demeaned him. Still, Bailey had been giving Shapiro very specific advice since the day he was retained. From his days as a private investigator during law school, Bailey never lost faith in their value. He urged Shapiro to have his own investigators chase down any favorable leads in the case before they grew stale. In comparison, Shapiro had little experience with private eyes, besides Bill Pavlik, whom he had engaged earlier. So he deferred to Bailey on whom to hire and where to send them. Bailey didn't hesitate with his first suggestion. "Hire Pat McKenna and send him to Chicago." McKenna, an affable and hard-working native of that city, lived near Bailey's adopted home of West Palm Beach, Florida. And the two men had occasionally worked together on cases in the past. On hearing from Shapiro, and then Bailey, McKenna got himself on the first flight to Chicago to learn what he could about Simpson's brief stay there in the hours after the murders. McKenna found a chaotic scene at the O'Hare Plaza. Chicago cops, Los Angeles detectives, a swarm of reporters from around the world, not to mention agents from the United States Secret Service, who were preparing for an imminent visit by President Clinton to the hotel. Working an old connection with the Chicago police, McKenna managed to find a couple of people who had seen Simpson when he arrived in the city on his red-eye flight from L.A. These witnesses reported that O.J. seemed in relatively good spirits. His demeanor, it seemed, was not that of a killer. It was from tiny threads like these that McKenna and Bailey believed reasonable doubt could be knit. McKenna traveled on to Los Angeles, where the scene at Shapiro's office seemed peculiar in another way. After the intense activity of the prelim, Shapiro had resumed the more sporadic work habits that were his custom. He sent his colleagues cryptic memoranda. For example, on August 18th, Shapiro dispatched the following message to all the investigators. Goldman was fired, allegedly, from the California Pizza Kitchen for giving a customer a free Coke. I will follow up on this. When Shapiro was in his office, the investigators often found him autographing photographs of himself with a gold pen. Shapiro's on-again, off-again presence left his 19th floor office suite, nominally the nerve center of the case, directionless. Part of the reason was friction among the personnel. Shapiro had hired his own investigators, chief among them Bill Pavlik, who had brought the Furman file to the defense's attention. The prickly former LAPD detective did not enjoy outsiders like McKenna treading on his turf. The problems were exacerbated when Shapiro, again at Bailey's suggestion, hired another investigator, John McNally. A gruff ex-New York City cop, McNally had worked with Bailey for more than 20 years. McNally took an immediate dislike to Shapiro and his media-friendly ways. Shortly after McNally arrived, he was looking through some unopened boxes of discovery material when, to his astonishment, he saw a man wandering around the office taking pictures of everyone. It was Roger Sandler, the ubiquitous photographer for Time and Life. Confidential documents were everywhere, and McNally wanted to throw him out, but Shapiro had given Sandler free rein. Not wishing to intrude, and preoccupied with his own cases, Bailey initially spent little time in Los Angeles and heard only the complaints of McKenna and McNally. Bailey's one-on-one relationship with Shapiro remained close, and when he was in L.A., Bailey stayed at the Beverly Hills home of Shapiro's best friend, Michael Klein. Bailey tried to mollify his investigators as best he could and brought in another protege, Howard Harris, a database specialist whose mission was to computerize the voluminous files in the case. At one point, McKenna saw Shapiro only once over a period of several weeks, and that was when he went to Shapiro's house to install his son's computer. "Don't worry," Bailey told his investigators when they complained about Shapiro. "He just has a different style than we do. He's really very bright." For his part, Bailey mostly remained in Florida, although he did arrange for the first volume of his memoirs, The Defense Never Rests, to be reissued in paperback. A cheerful new blurb was added to the cover. O.J. Simpson's acclaimed defense attorney recreates his most famous wife murder cases. Through the summer, the tensions grew between the Shapiro camp, Pavlik and various part-timers, and the Bailey group, McKenna, McNally, and Harris. Their differences were partly philosophical. Bailey's team favored a minute dissection of the government's case. For example, McKenna and McNally, and sometimes even Bailey, repeatedly walked up and down Bundy Drive, knocking on doors, in an effort to locate witnesses who could contradict the prosecution's theory of when the dog started barking, and thus when the crime occurred. In this way, Bailey hoped they could undermine the government's case piece by piece. In contrast, Pavlik favored an all-or-nothing approach and accordingly spent much of his time chasing theories about the identity of the real killer. Almost daily, Pavlik would return to Shapiro's office with a breathless new theory. On June 22nd, for example, Pavlik sent Shapiro a memo that stated, "Rumor has it that Ron's lover discovered his infidelity with Nicole Simpson and killed them both." Pavlik had many other theories, however. "A house burglar saw the guys who did it," he announced one day. In his memorandum outlining this theory, Pavlik reported that he had spoken to the burglar, and he distinctly recalled hearing one of the suspects saying, "Slit the nigger fucking lovin' bitch." Unfortunately for the defense, this burglar also claimed that he had seen the murder of Polly Klass and a hit by John Gotti. "Goldman had semen in his ass, and it was a gay hit." The autopsy showed no such evidence, and Goldman wasn't gay. A marcher at a gay pride parade saw two men covered with blood at a phone booth yelling, "O.J. is gonna pay for what he did to us." "Too ridiculous even to consider. You're a fucking Martian," McNally told Pavlik. It didn't matter to Pavlik that his theories usually conflicted with one another. His enthusiasm was boundless, as was his contempt for Bailey's investigators. Howard Harris spent a great deal of time setting up a computer program that was supposed to give the defense team access to virtually every address and phone number in the Los Angeles area. On the day it was completed, Pavlik typed in his own name and he was delighted when nothing came up, even though he had lived in the same house for decades. One day, late in the summer, Shapiro invited all of the investigators to a screening of Forrest Gump, held at the Beverly Hills mansion of his friend, Robert Evans. Before the lights were lowered, Shapiro rose and addressed the group. "I know I haven't been too friendly. I've been accused of being too aloof," he said. "That's going to change." McNally, who loved to twit Shapiro, spoke up in response. "That's not the problem, Bob. The problem is, no one does any work out here." Shapiro ordered the movie to begin. By the time the jury selection was completed, McNally decided he had had enough. The last straw for him came when Shapiro told the investigators that Skip Taft, O.J.'s business manager, had told him there would have to be pay cuts all around. McNally was supposed to have received $22,500 for his work over the summer, and the bill hadn't yet been paid. Instead of taking a pay cut, John McNally returned to New York for good. The tensions among the defense investigators only replicated those that had been simmering, albeit more decorously, among the defense lawyers. When Cochran had been hired, there was no question that he ranked behind Shapiro in the unspoken but real hierarchy of the defense team. Yet the issue of Cochran's role in the upcoming trial, which had been left conspicuously unsettled all through the fall, weighed heavily on Shapiro. At one level, he never had the illusion that he could try the case by himself, and he welcomed Cochran to the team. But Shapiro all along saw himself as a sort of master of ceremonies for the defense, a notion that became increasingly untenable over time. Throughout the fall, Cochran spent increasing amounts of time at the jail with O.J., and Simpson became ever more enamored of Cochran and alienated from Shapiro, who had always loathed having to visit prisoners. Race, too, assumed ever more importance in the defense strategy, and Shapiro, notwithstanding his having launched the issue in the first place, hated confronting its incendiary aftermath. Simpson had hired Cochran as a trial lawyer, and the trial was fast approaching. How could Cochran remain number two? He couldn't. And the implications made Shapiro squirm. In a bid to forestall the inevitable, Shapiro made a final effort to keep control of the case in the only way he knew how. One afternoon, late in the jury selection process, Bailey and Kardashian were talking with Simpson in the tiny lockup beside Judge Ito's courtroom. Shapiro joined them and said he had just spoken to the prosecutors. He said that he now understood their theory of the case. "The prosecutors think that you were mad at Nicole because she didn't invite you to dinner at Metzaluna with the kids," Shapiro told Simpson. "They think you sat around your house getting pissed off, then went over to Nicole's, probably with the idea of slashing the tires on her car. There was some sort of confrontation at the house, and you killed her. Then Goldman showed up." The lawyers and their client listened to Shapiro's summary without comment. "So," Shapiro went on, "that leaves room for manslaughter, and Bob Kardashian would have to account for the knife, but that's probably no more than 5 years for accessory after the fact." There was stunned silence, incredulity that Shapiro would propose a plea bargain at this late date. But cutting deals was Shapiro's specialty, and making one now was the only way for him to remain in charge of the case. Simpson did not reject the proposal so much as ignore it. The conversation simply moved on to other topics. With this final gambit, Shapiro ignored his own lessons about the importance of deference to celebrity clients. There was no logical reason to suggest a plea at that moment. The Furman issue had poisoned the racial atmosphere surrounding the trial in a way that could only help the defense. Thanks to Cochran, jury selection seemed likely to produce a politicized pro-defense panel. By proposing that Simpson agree to plead guilty to anything, at a time when O.J.'s outright acquittal was more likely than ever, Shapiro alienated his client beyond measure. Likewise, Kardashian, Simpson's most loyal courtier. Shapiro's prompt departure from leadership of the case became, at that moment, inevitable. The impending end of his reign as lead defense counsel led Shapiro into increasingly erratic behavior. In early December, he sent several reporters who were covering the case, including me, a gift. It was a large bottle of men's cologne, the brand DNA. News of the gift promptly leaked, of course, and virtually all the reporters stressed the inappropriateness of the gesture. Like many of the reporters, I sent mine back with a polite note. Even Shapiro's friend Michael Klein was appalled. Klein told him, "Bob, don't you realize that two people are dead in this case?" Klein also figured in another bizarre Shapiro episode. Later in December, Shapiro decided to take his wife and two sons to Hawaii for a brief vacation. Klein set up the trip through United Airlines, where he had high-level connections. The day before Shapiro's scheduled departure, the lawyer called Klein in a panic. He demanded that Klein change his reservations to a pseudonym, Tony DeMilo. Klein didn't understand the need for secrecy. All the while wondering about his friend's stability, he agreed to put through the change. It was a pointless formality, of course, for Shapiro was instantly recognized both on the plane and at his hotel. While in Hawaii, Shapiro also put in a strange phone call to Bailey. Still hoping to salvage control of the case, Shapiro beseeched Bailey. "You gotta get Johnny to back off." Bailey was noncommittal to Shapiro, but he would tell Cochran no such thing. A savvy political creature himself, Bailey saw that Shapiro had at this point no chance of remaining in charge. Indeed, Bailey had spent much of the fall cultivating Cochran so that he, Bailey, would be able to carve out a significant role at the trial. Almost in passing during this long conversation from Hawaii, Shapiro mentioned Bailey's financial status in the case. This is always a prickly subject among lawyers, and Bailey's arrangement had been conspicuously vague for several months. But Bailey had had other business, and his time commitment to Simpson had been modest, so he hadn't pressed for a resolution of the issue. Still, Bailey was not prepared for what Shapiro told him from Hawaii. "You know you're a volunteer, right?" Bailey was, though he didn't know it. Shapiro's retainer agreement with Simpson was contained in a letter dated August 24, 1994. Shapiro never showed this agreement to Bailey. "Dear OJ," the letter read, "you will compensate me for my personal legal services through the end of the trial in the sum of $1,200,000, payable as soon as reasonably possible, but no later than in monthly installments of not less than $100,000. The letter went on to state, "You will not be responsible for any additional payment of fees for legal services performed by F. Lee Bailey, which shall be my responsibility, if any." Cochran's separate agreement called for a fee to him of $500,000. Bailey knew none of this at the time, nor could he know, of course, that once Shapiro's role in the trial was reduced, he would stop receiving the monthly checks, and that he would ultimately receive only about $700,000 from Simpson, plus expenses. At the time of the phone call, Bailey was enraged by Shapiro's presumptuous reference to his status, not to mention the status itself. Bailey was in the Simpson case more for ego gratification than for money, but he found Shapiro's treatment of him demeaning. Bailey later negotiated a modest retainer agreement of his own with Skip Taft, OJ's business manager. In this phone call from Hawaii, Shapiro succeeded only in alienating Bailey, an erstwhile ally. It would soon become clear that Shapiro had no allies left. As part of his effort to ingratiate himself with Cochran, on December 21st, Bailey sent Cochran a 13-page, single-spaced memorandum as a preliminary effort, i.e., a first cut, to bring the preferred trial strategies and tactics in the forthcoming trial into focus. The memo, which turned out to be remarkably prescient, laid out a number of defenses to be used at the trial. They included demeanor evidence, proof that Simpson was the usual, relaxed, happy, affable O.J. before his trip to Chicago. Once he learns of the murder, his affect reverses. There was also the timeline defense, to demonstrate that at no time is there a window of 15 or more minutes when O.J. could have snuck off and committed the crime. About the timeline, Bailey wrote, "Properly orchestrated, this can be a powerful garden in which reasonable doubt can grow and flourish." There was also lack of motive, no reason why Simpson would butcher the mother of the two small children he adored, especially in light of his manifest equanimity when confronted with Nicole's sexual expeditions. "In sum," Bailey wrote, "the evidence in the case warrants a demeanor of controlled indignance. This ought not to be a polite request to the jury, but a formal demand supported by a foundation of appropriate righteousness. The manner in which the investigation in this case was botched from beginning to end, including protection and preservation of the crime scene, intervention of the medical team, letting the Broncos sit about for all to enter, delaying the blood testing unconscionably, and salting the blood evidence to incriminate O.J., will be described by historians as a blight on the face of justice." In a footnote to this peroration, Bailey showed just how well he understood the case. "None of the above will have much value," he wrote, "unless and until it is translated into the downtown dialect by our able colleague Cochran. Given the makeup of the jury, he would probably be very effective at delivering his translation himself." Pat McKenna had only the residue of an unpleasant divorce to return to in Florida, so, unlike McNally, he decided to stay on in Los Angeles, even with a pay cut. He and Harris did take a brief Christmas vacation, and when they returned to Shapiro's office on January 4, 1995, they sensed a distinct chill from Shapiro's secretary, Bonnie Barron. McKenna gave her a hug, as was his custom, and Barron kept her hands at her sides. Harris and McKenna were still puzzling over Barron's reaction to them when, later that night, they were having a drink at the Bel Age Hotel. As they were chatting, Harris's cellular phone rang. The caller was Kristen Jeanette Myers, an energetic reporter who was covering the defense team for Court TV. Harris listened for a moment. A big grin spread across his face, and then he started repeating the same phrase over and over again. "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." When Harris handed the phone to McKenna and he heard what Jeanette Myers was saying, McKenna reacted the same way. This was why Barron was upset. Jeanette Myers was reading them a column by Mike McCallery from that day's New York Daily News, headlined, "Vane Shapiro Deserves His Fate." It began, "He has spent a year fooling the nation, this lawyer. He has made them all believers that he is a heroic, hard-working lawyer in the hunt for a grand, fantastic verdict. Unfortunately, Robert Shapiro is your typical Hollywood invention, a character only 10 deep in makeup and significance." The column was filled with details known only to a handful of insiders. It mentioned how Shapiro had recently taken a vacation to Maui, in which he flew first class and his kids traveled coach, and had registered at the Grand Wailea Hotel under the alias Tony DeMilo. "Unlike Venus," McCallery quipped, "this statue is headless." McCallery observed that Shapiro has amazed members of the defense team with his unfamiliarity with the facts. Shapiro thought, for example, that on the night of the murders, Ron Goldman had walked from his waiter's post at Metzaluna to Nicole's house, when in fact he drove a borrowed car. The story went on to detail Shapiro's vanity, in particular how he had hired an extra secretary to clip stories about him out of newspapers. The designated clipper was actually Petra Brando, daughter of Marlon and sister of Shapiro's one-time client, Christian. McCallery's story concluded by explaining how Shapiro had recently decided to cut back on defense team expenses. From his first-class plane seat, Shapiro phoned the office and fired one of the secretaries he hired with OJ's money to snip the name Robert Shapiro out of newspapers. After hearing the column read to them, McKenna and Harris had no doubt about what to do next. Still using Harris's cellular phone, they dialed John McNally in New York. Chuckling, McKenna asked McNally, "You crazy fuck! How could you give that shit to the papers about Shapiro?" McNally laughed right back at him. "Fuck him," McNally said. "He's an asshole anyway. And besides, he still owes me money." McCallery's column prompted no laughter from Bob Shapiro. He had been stewing for weeks, torn by conflicting emotions about his role in the case. On the one hand, he loved his newfound social prominence, and he reveled in the attention he received at restaurants and public occasions. When, over the summer, the big-screen video projector at the Rose Bowl focused on him during a Rolling Stones concert, Shapiro waved his arms with delight, and the crowd cheered. But it also galled Shapiro that the press sniped at his many public appearances. On December 25, 1994, just before McCallery's column ran, a gossip column in the Los Angeles Times sniffed that Shapiro goes to the opening of every bleeping door. Simpson himself had taken note of Shapiro's high public profile and asked him to lower it. Shapiro complied, but the instruction irritated him and enraged his wife, Lynell, who relished their nights out together. The McCallery column attacked Shapiro's refined sense of his own dignity. Furious, he asked Bill Pavlik to conduct a secret investigation to see who had leaked the inside information. And Pavlik quickly came back with the predictable report that it was McNally. Rather than blame McNally, Shapiro fixated on Bailey, whom he held responsible for the investigator's hostility. So Shapiro decided to strike back in similar terms. He leaked word to Newsweek's Mark Miller that he was no longer speaking to his old friend Bailey. In the issue that was released on Sunday, January 15, 1995, Miller broke word of the breach in the defense camp. The Newsweek report stated that an unnamed defense source, obviously Shapiro, believed that Bailey-inspired saboteurs on our own team have been working to destroy Shapiro's credibility and reputation through leaks to the media. David Margolik, the New York Times reporter covering the case, followed up by calling Shapiro that Sunday. This time, Shapiro agreed to go on the record. Margolik wrote on January 16th that an extraordinary and apparently irreparable break has developed between Shapiro and Bailey. Margolik quoted Shapiro as saying, "The landmark word to me is loyalty. I felt a lifelong commitment to him because he gave me the opportunity to represent him when his professional reputation was at stake. But recent events have been so painful that we'll never be able to have a relationship again." Shapiro told Margolik that he hoped Bailey would leave the defense team. "His presence before this particular jury adds nothing that can't be done by Johnny and others on the team. But as for the final word on whether Bailey stayed or went, I'm leaving that decision to Mr. Cochran." When the Los Angeles Times joined in the next day, Shapiro is even more scathing. "We can't have snakes sleeping in the bed with us," he said. Cases involving multiple defense lawyers invariably generate internal tensions, but Shapiro's public attack on a colleague was unprecedented. Shapiro was on the warpath privately, too. He insisted that his friend Michael Klein evict Bailey as his house guest, and Klein, with some embarrassment, did so. As much as anyone on the defense team, Shapiro understood the importance of public relations. At this moment, on the eve of opening statements, the only priority should have been to stress Simpson's innocence, or at least the weaknesses in the government's case. Instead, with his client's freedom for the rest of his life on the line, Shapiro shifted the focus to his own complaints. to O.J.'s clear detriment. In times of crisis, as during his press conference after Simpson disappeared on June 17th, Shapiro invariably placed his own interests above those of his client. Worse yet, his grievances with Bailey were largely unjustified. While McNally had indeed attacked Shapiro in the press, Bailey himself was innocent of this kind of chicanery. In response to Shapiro's tirades, Bailey knew that he had to take the high road. In a statement released through his office, Bailey said only that he declined to disparage Mr. Shapiro in any way. This case is not about Mr. Shapiro and Mr. Bailey. It is about O.J. Simpson. The controversy ended the only way it could. Simpson demanded that all his attorneys meet him at the jailhouse and end all public feuding. "I played football with plenty of guys I didn't like," Simpson told them. "But it was a team, and we got along. Your job is to get along." On the morning of Wednesday, January 18th, the lawyers met at Cochran's office shortly after 7. Roosevelt Greer, the minister and former football star, was there, and he approached Shapiro. "I've looked into this situation, and I believe that Brother Bailey is innocent of what you think he did to you," Greer said. "I believe you should apologize to him." Now completely alone on the defense team, Shapiro had no choice but to utter a few perfunctory words of contrition to Bailey. Also, in response to Greer's suggestion, Shapiro and Bailey arrived at the courthouse together. Press reports said that the two men had arrived arm in arm, and that was, at some level, technically true. As they left Shapiro's car, Bailey placed his hand on Shapiro's wrist. For a moment, Shapiro regarded Bailey's hand as one might look upon a putrid fish. Shapiro did not exactly recoil, but he marched down the steps to the door with a cross between a smile and a grimace on his face. After court that day, the lawyers returned to the lobby for a news conference. Cochran, now clearly the leader of the defense team, stood between Bailey and Shapiro, and he beamed while announcing that the defense was a united front. "The dream team is never going to break up," Cochran proclaimed. Shapiro, looking pained, nodded dutifully. Asked about the controversy, Bailey said simply, "That's history." The unity tableau was marred only by the presence, in the background, behind the first-string lawyers, of Cochran's young associate, Sean Chapman, and Shapiro's junior colleague, Sarah Kaplan. Every time the lawyers told the reporters that the feud was over, history, forgotten, and unimportant, the two underlings, who had enjoyed front-row seats to the diatribes, started to laugh. Shapiro sulked. In court, he sat at the opposite end of the defense table from Bailey, and for the next 9 months, the two men did not exchange a word. Outside the criminal courts building, Shapiro's petulance took another form. Slowly but inexorably, he began broadening the circle of people to whom he told his true feelings about his client. From the start of Shapiro's representation, his wife, Lynell, had never had any compunction about sharing her views at social gatherings. Guilty, guilty, guilty. Both inside and outside the defense team offices, particularly as the racial polarization about the case intensified, Shapiro decided to prove his kinship with the West Los Angeles world that meant so much to him. Their view of the case was his, too. "Of course he did it," Shapiro would say. For his part, Bailey, who never worried too much about any client's guilt or innocence, just wanted to return to the big time. Indeed, one irony of Shapiro's attack on Bailey is that it was launched before Bailey had uttered a single word in Judge Ito's courtroom. In the last legal argument before opening statements, Bailey would finally speak in that court for the first time. Prosecutors had urged Ito to let them introduce evidence of Simpson's pattern of domestic violence against Nicole as proof that he murdered her. This was an important controversy for Ito to resolve, but in a rather minor sideline to the main issue, prosecutors called to the stand a Canadian expert to testify about domestic violence in general. Late on a sleepy Thursday afternoon, Bailey rose to cross-examine Dr. Donald Dutton of Vancouver. Nature has favored Bailey with a glorious voice, which summons a stream of doers tumbling down a pebbly brook. His hands tremble a good deal, but with one in his pocket and the other on the lectern, Bailey can still command a moment. He speaks a language that has almost vanished from American courtrooms, a kind of British English that combines wry whimsy and Baroque locution. When Dr. Dutton didn't understand a question, Bailey attributed it to the vicissitudes of give and take. And when the Canadian witness was not clear on another matter, Bailey asked to see if we can surmount the barrier of our common language. In his redirect examination, Prosecutor Scott Gordon at one point asked Dutton to explain a phrase he had used, narcissistic personality. A narcissistic personality, the expert explained, will be someone who has an exaggerated or grandiose view of their own importance, who needed a constant kind of reinforcement, who overreacted to any kind of slight criticisms, and was incapable of developing empathy with other people. In the silence before the next question, Bailey took a long look at his colleagues on the defense team. Then he leaned over and whispered to Jerry Ullman, "Sounds like everyone at this table."
Context of white supremacy. We are at Chapter 12, A Visit from Larry King. That will be our next audio segment for the week. We will get to the phone lines. The number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. I will share a little bit, since we are reading from Mr. Toobin's work. I've been trying to include, there's so many O.J. Simpson books, I'm trying to include some of the other perspectives from folks who lived through and are being written about in Mr. Toobin's work. So Johnny L. Cochran Jr., his book Journey to Justice, which mostly is not about O.J. Simpson, is about his life and family and other things, but as I said, about the last third of this book is dedicated to the O.J. Simpson trial. Just, I think importantly, Toobin's book was published before Johnny Cochran's book. So covering the same point that we are talking about today, again, this is kind of the nebulous period. The jury has been selected, and this is like the few months leading up to the trial, which started at the early portion, like the end of January 1995. So page 254, Johnny Cochran writes, 4 days after the arraignment, on Tuesday, July 26, the defense team held its first general meeting. From the outset, it was clear to me that the case had already outgrown both the resources of Shapiro's modest staff and the ability of his cramped physical facilities to accommodate it, even allowing for the rapid pace at which Bob quite correctly had elected to proceed toward trial. The disarray was troubling. Bob rented space from a large Century City law firm, and there just wasn't enough room to accommodate everything and everyone we needed. Files were spilling across the floor, phones were constantly tied up, and Jerry Ullman, our team's most distinguished member, was forced to work on critical and sensitive motions at a table in the firm's law library while clerks and other attorneys streamed in and out. Even parking was a problem.
since Shapiro had no assigned spaces or the ability to validate our tickets, it cost each one of us $16 every time we had to go to his office. Now, do the inflation on that. So you're talking like $100 a day for parking? Yikes. We met that day in one of the conference rooms. Ullman and I were there along with Carl Douglas, Sean Chapman, as well as three investigators, Pavlik, McNally, and McKenna. Sarah Kaplan, a very capable associate of Shapiro's who would ultimately leave the team, was present, as was Barry Scheck. Shortly after we began, Dr. Henry Lee joined us while Michael Baden and Alan Dershowitz participated by speakerphone. But nothing had quite prepared us for the way in which Bob began the meeting. How many people here think O.J. Simpson is guilty? He asked, looking around the table. It was an astounding way to begin organizing the defense of a client who never once ceased to assert his innocence of the crimes of which he was accused. What the hell was that about? Carl demanded nearly 3 hours later as he, Sean, and I made our way to our car. Carl often plays the role of devil's advocate when we discuss cases. I suggested to him that perhaps Bob simply was doing the same. But from the looks on their faces, I could see neither he nor Sean was buying it. And the truth was I couldn't even convince myself. Still, we had signed on as members of a team, and as I reminded them, we owed it to our client to try and make it work. But it wasn't going to be easy. At the close of our meetings, whose numbers seemed to grow in inverse proportion to their productivity, Bob on occasion would ask Carl, Sean, and the investigators to leave the room so that he could discuss some sensitive item with the team's senior members. It was deeply insulting, especially to my associates who were used to functioning in an office where work, information, and trust were shared equally. Carl quite rightly resented the whole business and would wait outside for me, seething somewhere between rage and tears. The whole charade was pointless anyway, since the minute I emerged, I would brief them both on whatever had been discussed. Usually, it was nothing more than one of the tidbits of Hollywood gossip that seemed to cling to Bob like lint. Once, for example, he breathlessly informed us that he had obtained information that Nicole had carried on a lesbian relationship with her friend Faye Resnick. The rest of us looked at each other and then at the floor. On another occasion, while the rest of the team scrambled to keep abreast of the case while preparing for jury selection, Bob confided that he had been preparing a list of films in which courageous juries acquit the accused. We have to be more concerned with the climate of public opinion, he explained, so I plan to use my contacts with network and cable executives to get them to program as many of these movies as we can get on before jury selection starts. Well, I thought, it's a dirty job, but I continued to chalk much of this up to Bob's inexperience with murder cases. Moreover, I was adamant about tuning everything else out so I could prepare for jury selection, my first task for the team. Skipping, because we already covered this, he's just going over jury selection. A little bit more just about the section that we just heard, and then we'll get to the caller. So I'm skipping to page 262. Mr. Cochran continues, by November 3, we had a jury of 8 women and 4 men. 8 of the panelists were African American, 1 was white, 1 was Latino, and 2 were mixed. Oh, I think I'm remembering. I clearly recall driving home the night we finished and thinking I never picked a better jury. Much later that same evening, in fact, I spoke with one of the Los Angeles Times reporters with whom I was to speak frequently during the trial. What sort of jury have you got? He asked. These are my people, I replied. I know their hearts, and they know mine. And when the time comes, that's how I'm going to speak to them heart to heart. I wasn't the only one to take note of what we'd accomplished. As he did throughout the trial, O.J. spoke frequently by telephone with Alan Dershowitz at Harvard. Whatever you do, Alan told O.J. that night, make sure you keep Johnny Cochran between you and that jury. Jury selection did not end Joellen Demetrius's involvement with our team. She continued to conduct focus groups for us with panels matching the composition of our jury at the time. Her advice would prove critical months later when we agonized over the question of whether O.J. should take the stand. The satisfaction I felt about our collaboration with Joellen could not eclipse my growing disillusionment with Bob Shapiro and my anxiety about where he might be taking our client. Other members of the team, including the unfailingly kind and generous Gary Ullman, had begun to grumble about the amount of time Bob spent on the phone chatting during the day and all the evenings and weekends he seemed to find free for social events. Some corroboration. Early in the process, for example, I had erupted when he announced that a Life magazine photographer would be attending our meetings at his office to preserve them. Bob, I said, there are inviolable issues of attorney-client privilege here, and we just can't have this. When the other attorneys seconded my sentiments, Shapiro reluctantly agreed. Then, one Sunday, in the very midst of jury selection, he announced that we all were to gather at his office to pose for a group portrait for Vanity Fair photographer Annie Leibovitz, a wonderful artist in her own right. She is the one who did the photograph of LeBron James clutching the gorilla. Clutching the white woman. That's very similar to the King Kong pose. Remember that one? That's her. She also did the photo of Tiger Woods with no shirt on. She's done a lot of very interesting shoots over the years, Annie Leibovitz, suspected race soldier. Anywho, there was no time. I phoned Bob and told him I wasn't coming. He protested that all the arrangements had been made and that Leibovitz had flown in from New York just to take this picture. Bob, we've all got too much to do. Go ahead and take the photo without me, I said and hung up. Coincidentally, Simpson phoned me from the jail a few minutes later. OJ, I said, they want me to drive all the way out to Century City for some magazine picture. I just don't have time for this. I'm working, and so are Sean and Carl. You're absolutely right, OJ replied, a note of what I thought was relief creeping into his voice. I don't want you to go. I'm glad you're not doing it. One morning a few days later, when I climbed into the back seat of the car alongside him, Bob suddenly announced, I've got it. Got what? I asked gingerly, hoping he was not about to describe some kind of health problem. I got the Rona. That was a good one, Mr. Cochran. Good job. Good job. I figured out what happened. OJ went to Nicole's house to key scratch her car. He found her with Goldman, flew into an uncontrollable rage, and killed them both before he knew what happened. Bob, those people were murdered with a knife, not a key, I pointed out. Okay, he said brightly. He went there to key her car and slash her tires. Bob, I said, struggling to sound more patient than I felt. Our client has told us he is innocent. He says he did not kill those people. He has never told me anything else. Has he told you something different? No, of course not, Shapiro replied. Then what are we talking about? I said with some exasperation. But I knew exactly what we were talking about. The kinds of facts that might have set up a manslaughter plea if they happened to be true. Undeterred by my lack of enthusiasm, Shapiro later tried out his theory on O.J. himself, while other team members listened in horror. Simpson's response was the appropriate one. You've got to be out of your mind. It's fair to say that as my good opinion of Bob Shapiro declined, the esteem in which I held F. Lee Bailey, with whom I had never worked before, increased. Lee had done a masterful job analyzing the timeline evidence during the case's early days, flying out from his home in Florida to focus on that soon after O.J.'s arrest. He had piloted his own helicopter over Brentwood while his technical assistant, Howard Harris, took aerial photographs, which they then assembled in an overhead map. By driving and walking every possible route between Bundy and Rockingham and then correlating the times and distances with aerial survey and the witness statements, Lee became convinced that the prosecution's timeline would never stand up in court. As it happened, our jury concurred. Lee was also a valuable continuing source of memos on trial strategy. Unfortunately, his relations with Shapiro, who had once been his close friend, rapidly deteriorated. There were quarrels over money. McKenna and McNally, Lee's investigators, grew increasingly hostile to Bob. Throughout November and December, we were plagued by leaks, many of them to the tabloid press, which was prepared to pay well for any story about O.J. Bailey and his people believed they had proof that Bob was the source of at least one leak, the transcript of O.J.'s interview with Lang and Van Natter to the Star. Shapiro was equally insistent that Bailey's staff was doing the leaking. It was a mess that deepened when Lee, who was not being paid at that point, discovered during a visit with our client that Shapiro had told O.J. that Bailey would remain in Los Angeles throughout the entire trial. Lee, who dislikes California courts and the pace of our trials, was stunned. He did tell us about that when he visited with us, F. Lee Bailey. As we broke for the holidays, it was becoming increasingly clear to everyone, including Simpson, that something would have to be done to resolve the situation. And with the actual presentation of evidence looming, I was becoming even more anxious about the posture of our case and our ability to respond to the unpredictable demands of a high-profile murder trial. On December 18, Bailey and I met in New York, where we each happened to have other business. Look, here's where we are, Lee said. O.J. had made it clear to me that he expects me to stay. I'm not talking to Shapiro anymore, but clearly he shouldn't be trying this case. O.J. doesn't want him to, and he is indicating to me that he wants me to do at least some of the work with you in charge. You have to tell me how you feel. I'm not happy about being in California, but I have a chance to make a pretty good deal on an apartment, but I have to decide quickly. Knowing how both O.J. and I felt about Lee, the answer was easy. I would like you to come, I said. By then, events were moving rapidly, primarily at the behest of our client, who even in custody remained very much on top of his affairs, particularly when money was involved. He had become especially incensed, for example, when he discovered that Shapiro's landlords were charging him $4,000 every time they turned on their conference room air conditioning for one of our weekend meetings. He was also alarmed by what he perceived as the continuing disorganization of our case files and evidence. I'm just pausing right here. Remember when Jeffrey Toobin did all that talking about O.J. Simpson is illiterate and dumb and stupid, and he doesn't know anything, and his clients, his attorneys sat around and lied to try to make it seem like he was some sort of intellectual equal and he was involved in it. Remember all that? He said he's just some dumb, illiterate black jock. He doesn't know anything, and it's just been a lie to say he knows something about the defense. Continuing. disorganization. Speaking of disorganization, on December 27, O.J. called Carl Douglas, whose long hours and attention to detail had won his admiration. Simpson told Carl he wanted him to take over management of the case materials, even if that meant shifting everything from Century City to our Mid-Wilshire offices. At the request of OJ and Skip Taft, we faxed Shapiro, who was vacationing with his family in Hawaii, and informed him that all future meetings would occur at our offices and all future travel and housing arrangements for witnesses would be made by our secretaries. On the morning of January 2, 1995, OJ asked me to come to the jail early so that he and I could talk with Shapiro. The time had come, he said, for me to assume formal control over the case. Time was too short, the presentation of evidence too near for further bickering and confusion. OJ had become particularly alarmed based on a telephone conversation that Lee Bailey had had with Shapiro. According to Lee, Bob had said Cochran should just get out of there. I am the perfect person to try this case. That, O.J. said, was the furthest thing from his mind. When Bob arrived, he took the news badly. I've been stabbed in the back. Lots of stabbing, he said. You just want me to sit there like window dressing. Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to quit. That, as I learned a few minutes before, was precisely what the ever-shrewd O.J. Simpson wanted to avoid. Shrewd O.J. Simpson? I've never heard that in my life. He was wise in the ways of the Hollywood circles in which Shapiro paddled, and he feared what an embittered former defense attorney with a fondness for the press might do. He had been advised by his friends to keep Shapiro on board, and that's what he set about doing. About that time, Bailey arrived, and the atmosphere became even more tense. For a man with a football background, O.J. Simpson has an almost visceral dislike of confrontation. He began to smooth the whole thing over with the sorts of sports analogies of which both he and Shapiro are so fond. Bob could be the coach, he suggested, while Lee and I carried the ball and the other lawyers functioned as specialty players. Shapiro was having none of that. You're benching me. That's what you're doing. And I'm going to quit. Okay, okay, replied O.J. Simpson, the Heisman Trophy winner. Johnny will be the running back, Lee will be the fullback, and you, Bob, can be the quarterback. Only from now on, there's no more passing. Doesn't that idiot on the compensatory call-in say no metaphors? Woo, man, oh, man. Actually, I never believed Bob Shapiro, the $5 million man, had any intention of leaving the case. We all sat through a somewhat tense meeting at my offices that afternoon, but whatever Bob's unhappiness, it was clear that the rest of the team was relieved to be in a place where there were a secure war room, private offices, multiple conference rooms, and a large and helpful support staff. But when the meeting broke up, Shapiro and Dershowitz, who had flown in that day, headed back to the jail. When we reconvened the next morning, Bob stormed in and took the seat at the head of my conference table. Everybody sit down now, he ordered. I have had a meeting with OJ. I am in charge. There is no question about it. Damn it, Lee Bailey exploded. You've been down there threatening the client. Even I don't believe it. You know, Bob, I have a lot of trouble with this. I was there, Dershowitz interjected. I heard O.J. say that. Alan, I don't care what you heard O.J. say, Bailey snarled. He certainly was forced into any statement putting Bob Shapiro back in charge. He told me personally that he didn't want that. I had prepared myself for this scene and sat silently until the angry mutterings around the table ceased. Tell the truth, Bob, I said. OJ called me right after you guys left the jail. He was beside himself at your behavior. He's going to call here in a minute. I'm going to put him on the speakerphone and let him tell everybody for himself who's in charge. I'm going to put an end to this. As if on cue, the phone rang. O.J. spoke quietly but firmly for a few minutes and then concluded, I want Johnny to be my lead attorney, and I want the rest of you to do what he tells you. As he spoke those words, there were audible sighs all around the table. Mine was a prayer of thanksgiving, nearly 5 months after I had accepted the responsibility of becoming O.J. Simpson's advocate. I finally had the opportunity to do all I believed needed to be done for him. I felt like a victory, and I prayed it also was an omen. That is the conclusion of the chapter. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. As I said, this is such a rich case in terms of sources. And since there's a question about how truthful is Jeffrey Toobin being, it's nice to kind of fill this one in with some other perspectives. See, we got some overlap, a little bit of difference. If you have thoughts, observations to share, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Let's see. See, maybe folks are getting their thoughts together from all of the additional reading we had from Mr. Cochran. While folks are getting their first thoughts together, let's see. One of our investors wrote in. He writes, fascinating interview with Mr. Singular. I am a former avid listener of Howard Stern. Wait till we start filtering in the Howard Stern commentary next week. Man, oh, man. He did daily coverage of the trial from the end of January through October. What a time capsule of white supremacy racism circa 1995. Wow. Anyway, avid listener of Howard Stern, and recall his months-long disparaging of O.J. Simpson, Johnny Cochran, Judge Lance Ito, who he nicknamed Captain Japan, and the black jurors. Oh, man, does he lambast the black jurors day after day after day after day. No count, ignorant, one-tooth black people. How can you – they can't even add one plus one is two. They can't even spell jury. How are you going to put them on a jury? We talked about that yesterday, Don Imus. Anyway, whew, still learning, aren't we all? Chapter 11. Number one, Bailey, then on scholarship to Harvard, where he drifted on gentlemen's seas. I remember the phrase being used in reference to former President George W. Bush. I think it is white code for that he barely passed. In other words, affirmative action for white males. Number two, their theory of the case, the prosecutors think that you were mad at Nicole because she didn't invite you to dinner. Boy, was I duped. It sounds so absurd now. I can only say I have said the same thing so many times. Like, I cannot believe I thought O.J. Simpson was guilty for like 30 seconds, much less like years of things. Oh, yeah, he had to do it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He tricked us all. He slipped over there and he cut them all up and diced them and ran back across town and changed his clothes and hid the knife in Chicago. And oh, yeah, he did all that. He skipped out on his arthritis medication and, you know, he tricked us with it. Oh, yeah, he did it all. He did it all. Still learning. Number three, it was a large bottle of men's cologne, the brand DNA. Tacky. Trashy. Terroristic. Triple T, always. Number four, Bailey sent Cochran a 13-page single-spaced memorandum, preferred trial strategies, Epley Bailey was by far the most nationally known of the Dream Team members at the time of the trial. I've always assumed he was past his prime and was brought on primarily for his name recognition. Seems that Bailey was much more important to the team than I thought. Seems like he did do quite a bit. Just some of the basics. I think his book is titled The Architect of the Dream Team in terms of strategy and what have you. I know what we just heard from Johnny Cochran. He seemed to have a lot of appreciation for what he was doing and getting in his helicopter and doing all that scheming. Number five, Downtown Dialect by our able colleague Cochran. In other words, old Johnny speaks dat Negrees. How insulting. Indeed. Number six, I played football with plenty of guys I didn't like, Simpson told them, but it was a team and we get along. Your job is to get along. I think this refutes Toobin's statement that OJ was uninvolved with the defense. I think we've had a lot to refute that, like from within Toobin's own book and from some of the other sources, that OJ Simpson was just some ignorant brute. And he didn't exactly understand, or, you know, he couldn't contribute anything to the team. I think we've had a lot to refute that. Anyway, let's see. He has other commentary, but we haven't got that far in the book yet. Let's see. Folks who dialed in with commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello, Gus, and greetings to the callers. This is 0526 from South Central Los Angeles. And I wrote down a note about Shapiro, how he was behaving during this trial. And I wrote that white people do not care about black people. We're just an object and whatever fantasy they're playing in their head and used and to be used as a pawn for whatever motives they have. Because this man is putting his feelings and ego above OJ's life, but Urugu teaches us that this should be expected. That'll be all.
Indeed. Much obliged, sir. I think lots of folks were accused of that throughout the trial, of not being concerned. Even folks, you know, who are on the defense team, like Mr. Shapiro, who, hey, like you have a man's life in your hands, you know, like they were discussing the death penalty in this case. Like literally OJ Simpson could have lost his life in all of this. And you're talking about photo shoots and what have you, like, what the hell, what is going on? And this will continue from now to the final verdict, these kind of accusations, like, what is going on here? What is, even the people who say, you know, hey, what about Nicole? What about Ron Goldman? You know, like, we got two dead white people. I'm trying to, can I get a movie part here? Can I get my photo shoot? Let me get my good side here. I want to get my Hawaii tan shown off here for the photographs. Move back, OJ. I'm trying to get my picture. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, much obliged, good sir. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, ma'am. May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Ohio.
So thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. Just a few comments, mainly about Shapiro. The part in Toobin's book, assuming that this was truthful, where he had mentioned that Shapiro, after the feud, began to publicly share his feelings of OJ's guilt and reply to people when he was asked about whether OJ was guilty or not. He would say, of course he's guilty. It seems like that's his way of reingratiating himself back into the white community or the suspected white supremacist community. I know in the book, I think Toobin said, for him to kind of, I forgot the exact word, but I guess basically connect with the LA community that he so loved, which I feel like the LA community, that's to me a synonym for the white community that he so loved. So it's a way for Shapiro to not only get the publicity from defending yet another high profile celebrity case, but to also make sure this does not damage his reputation as being a white supremacist. And it's interesting that Shapiro was not called like childish or juvenile or made or had any reference to being anything less than a man when the feud was going on, even how he didn't want to shake Mr. Bailey's hand. And it was described by Tubin that he basically looked at his hand like a putrid fish, and he kind of like grimaced, but almost scowled. It was something along those lines that he was describing as he walked away, I guess. And that's interesting when it seems like non-white people, their actions are very quickly described as being juvenile. The last thing that I'll mention, which I'm, drawing conclusions on, is that I do feel like Shapiro could be like a suspected white supremacist, not only based on his actions, assuming that they're truthful, that Tubin laid out, but also based on Furman in his book, Murder in Brentwood, because Tubin was saying how he basically was able to connect with Shapiro. And even on his, I think it was the perjury case, Shapiro had provided him some type of assistance or testimony. He didn't make the case against him any worse. And I think what I was going to mention, I'm not sure if we got to that part yet. So I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share. Oh, I'm sorry. One other thing. There was a part in that Tubin had mentioned about, was it information being leaked? And in Furman's book, he was accusing Mr. Cochran of leaking information to Tubin when it was actually Shapiro was the one who had met with Tubin. So that's the only other thing I want to add. Sorry, I'll mute my line.
Oh, wow. Now, that is significant. If Furman's book, if he's accusing Johnny Cochran of leaking information to Tubin to accuse him, when Jeffrey Tubin, right in his own book, has said, hey, I met with Shapiro. That's dramatized in the FX series. I met with Shapiro. He admitted that he met, and we talked about this, and he said, oh, yeah, I think this Furman guy might have planted evidence or what have you, and no, I got to pick a black person to pin this on and say, oh yeah, I gotta pin this on that old Johnny Cochran, no count black guy who did this to me, Mark Furman. Let's see, any other folks who dialed in, hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Greetings, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, callers and listeners. Thank you again, Gus, for the platform. Reading over Bob Shapiro's segment, it just sounds so typical of a racist and a quote-unquote narcissist. Like, he's just so centered around himself, while, again, like you mentioned earlier, you're dealing with a murder case and you're dealing with a man's life at hand, and he's so centered and focused on how he could take all the attention and gain more resources and power like a typical white racist. Like, it just, I mean, there's no escaping the fact that he was, because this is an individual that he knew, and he's using him almost like a parasitic kind of relationship, so to speak. And Jeffrey Tubin, while you were reading Johnny Cochran's segment there, I actually went online and started looking at the book itself, because that sounds like an interesting read. I'm very curious, along with that and the guest that came on earlier on, Mr. Singular, early yesterday, and he mentioned another book called Donald Free, by Donald Free, Killing Time. those seem like they would be a good mesh together to good, get a good compass or idea of exactly what was going on within this case more. And Lee Bailey, I was kind of surprised when you read that segment from Johnny Cochran's book, how he actually utilized his resources to enhance the case, to help Johnny Cochran and to help OJ overall. And it seemed like his work ethic was used as kind of like a springboard, like a basis to start from, to go, well, here's where we can have, you know, some proof and evidence to show that this couldn't have possibly happened due to the timeline. One other thing I was curious about is Johnny Cochran at the time, brought in by OJ, or was he brought in by Shapiro? I think I missed that segment. I'm not sure who actually brought him in. So I was just actually curious about that. With that said, I'll mute my line.
That's one of those where there's a discrepancy. Johnny Cochran in his book says that O.J. Simpson had been calling him. He said he used the word ritual, that O.J. Simpson had been calling him and calling him. I read that section a few weeks back, but he had been calling him, and that Mr. Cochran went and spoke with his father, his pastor, and all of this, and, you know, finally decided to get involved in the case. In Tubin's book, he makes it seem like O.J. Simpson was more ignorant, and that Shapiro was the one saying that, yeah, we got to do this race angle thing. We got to bring in Johnny Cochran. This will be the way that we can win the case. So that's more of the Tubin's angle that he presents, whereas, as I said, Johnny Cochran says, no, he had been O.J. Simpson, rather, had been calling him and calling him and calling him for weeks before he got in, that this was O.J. directly who wanted him to be engaged. Let's see. Irie in Louisiana, did you have commentary, ma'am?
Oh, hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, everybody, and good evening, Gus. I just had two quick questions. I don't know if it's not the appropriate time to ask, but for one of them, and one of them is, I'm just curious if anybody does have a theory or sort of a speculation of what did happen to Nicole and that other person, Ron Goldman. And then the other question I had is, are they going to get to the civil suit that followed the criminal in the criminal adjudication? Because I found it interesting, you know, that they were able to get damages from him even though he was vindicated criminally. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, ma'am. With regards to the second question, I'm sure there will be some mention of the – well, actually, I have to take that back. The audiobook, I suppose it's edited, right? Because this book was published in 96, so the civil trial hadn't even concluded. So unless we have an edited version, no, there's not going to be an updated version. I mean, no, we will not get any information about the civil trial, because this book was published in 96, and I don't think they had reached a verdict in the civil trial until 97. So unless this book is updated, no. That said, even if there is an update in the edited version, it's going to be very brief, because that trial, even though it didn't last as long as this one, like, we're about at the halfway point in this book, which means half of this book is going to be taken up with the trial. You could do a whole nother book on the civil trial and the differences and why didn't Mark Furman testify there and blah, 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 and, you know, all the rest of it. So just based on the publication date, I would think there can't be anything in here about that unless it was updated. And even then, it would have to be a very tiny, you know, paragraph or so that, oh, yes, vindication, he was convicted, civil trial, and, you know, that's about it. The other question, in terms of theory about what happened to them, they were killed. I think Mr. Freed's book, Killing Time, has some theories about, you know, what could have happened to them. There's a long list of hypotheses
about, you know, what could have happened if O.J. did it and how he did it. They have endless computer simulations of that. If O.J. did it with accomplices, if this was some sort of mafia hit, if this was a drug hit, or blah, 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 blah. Lots of those that, you know, you can research for a long time. I think even Mr. F. Lee Bailey talks about some of those other theories. And in fact, I think we should have the investigator, Pat McKenna, mentioned in the book this week. He should be on the program next week. We can ask him as well, see what he thinks. Does he have any theories where there seem to be some evidence, if there's one or two that seemed more likely, probable, that could have happened? We can ask him next week. But, oh, yeah, you can go down that rabbit hole. Lots and lots and lots of possibilities in terms of what might have happened to them. Let's see.
Yes, can I say something?
Red in Ohio.
Yes, just real quick, about the second question, if Tuba mentions the civil trial, it's no, not even in the epilogue. Just wanted to say that. I'll mute my line.
That's what I thought. Like, couldn't be. That would be a whole nother book, and lots of interesting, wacky things happened there. I mentioned some of that yesterday. They changed laws, literally, so that things that were not considered evidence now are evidence to help convict O.J. Simpson. Like, yeah, that would be a whole nother book about, you know, what happened, why was that, and all the rest of it. Let's see. I'll share a few notes.
Can I be heard?
Let's see. Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Good evening. Yeah, Shapiro was nothing more than a coach. Pat Riley, designer shoes, suit, silk tie, slick hair. And he just sat on the sidelines while the other lawyers did all the work, for the most part. He looked upon. There's no connections with private eyes, no plans to win the trial or even to try the case. Just looking to find a theory so he could cut a deal. You know, the worst kind of lawyer. I think they call them like ambulance chasers. And it's funny, in New York, they have the Kaufman firm, and they show the commercial. It seems like they have a lot of black lawyers. And other non-white lawyers that work at this firm, you know, that unless they're actors in the commercial, they appear to be the actual lawyers. And in one of the commercials, Robert Shapiro is doing the commercial for them. My good friend Johnny Cochran was all about, you know, freedom and justice. You know, it's just very eerie because I remember the trial and I didn't recall those two being that close of friends. F. E. Bailey and Shapiro not getting along was a story during the trial. You know, it was mostly speculation then, but that was a story. And I remember there was a lot of pointing fingers at each other from the Dream Teamers about the leaks during the trial when it was actually happening. Lastly, which he was talking about, Gus, law firm expenditures can be quite costly, especially if you have a client like O.J. Simpson. The inner workings of how these firms work is very interesting. The bigger the firm, the more expenses. Everything is locked, from the phones to the fax to the copy machines, the mail machines. To unlock them, you need to apply a client code first. Like, you know, you pick up the phone, you put the client code, it might be 6 digits, and then that allows, then you get the ringtone, and now they're going to charge that client $1.25 every minute you use that phone. That's the only way you can use the phone, only way you can make a copy machine. When I worked in the copy center, we were charging $1.50 a sheet of paper, $3 if they wanted color ink on it, and you could throw out a lot. So I worked at a firm, and I would have to call on the weekends if they wanted to work the weekend for air conditioner or the heat to be put on for them in the office because it was a busy case or whatever. and you apply the code to the work order with the building for that. So I can see how OJ's looking at his money. Like, where's all this expense? Even lunch, like, sometimes you didn't have lunch. I was working on this copy job. I'm going to apply the code and get me some lunch, you know? And then he just deliver it. It's just how it works. So I could see him totally flabbergasted looking at the bill he was getting as a black guy, as someone they expect him to be rich. And then in this type of firm where it's not going to last a long time, it's not like they're doing corporations, so they're going to get as much as they can out of it. And I'll be my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York, retired firefighter in New York. Did you have commentary, sir?
Well, I'm not exactly in New York. I'm in Miami Gardens, but
Florida.
I understand. I was just thinking. I was just thinking about the fact that the state of California, and this is relevant to what I hear white people complaining about a lot, no matter where they're from, about the waste of tax dollars and literally the prosecution spent, I would assume, millions of dollars to convict Renthal James Simpson, and not the murderer of two people. White people complain about the state wasting tax dollars. I didn't hear that much complaining by white people about tax dollars. And as I mentioned before, I think it was yesterday, there was no complaints about it. They really wanted to get OJ primarily because of his social status and him being a black person on top of it. Nicole Brown Simpson, his wife, and the other person that was murdered, according to California Hollywood standards, did not have any success enough for profit at all. Matter of fact, OJ made both of them. As far as attention, otherwise they would just been two dead white people. They got murdered. As far as that concerned. So OJ really made the entire case. And another thing that I get out of the whole book in itself is that white people, you cannot be a white person and don't have an understanding of racism, white supremacy. They will use that knowledge for any type of success that they can achieve out of it. And this case with those attorneys certainly is one classic example of what we're reading right now on how they can we're talking about a small number of white males who can immediately focus on another white person that is more obvious at their practice of racism, white supremacy, exploit that, and within a short period of time have a very good understanding that their client, who happens to be a non-white black person, will walk free. And in the aftermath of it, there has been no serious venture to actually find out what happened in the death of those two people. And those are my thoughts in the from the first half of the reading. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida, not New York. And yes, they did spend millions, not in the conviction, but in the prosecution of Renthal James. They were hopeful that this was going to be millions for the conviction, but no, all for naught. And in fact, I would say that is something. Now, I don't know if that's going to come up in the book or not, but ooh-wee, it comes up on Howard Stern
all the time. Like, I cannot believe we are wasting all this money, because that does get talked about a lot once the trial actually gets rolling. Like, wow, all of the technology and computer. You heard some of that this week. They got the helicopter to fly. Like, oh my God. Like, if this, what I said before, if this was Olden P. Saxton, we would have spent $5. This would have been pleaded out. You'd have been hopeful to not get the death penalty, life without parole, and get on. We wouldn't have had anything to talk about. Wouldn't have been no Jeff Toobin books, and he could have masturbated, and nobody would have even heard about this. Or rental. Woo! That, I don't know if that's going to come up in the book, but we, a number of race soldiers, did. And, I mean, particularly as this went on and on and on, by the time we got to October, oh, yeah, a whole lot of folks did have a lot to say about, my God, this is appalling. How much money have we spent to sit here and watch Orenthal James and Johnny Cochran make a mockery of our justice? Yeah, we'll have to, I don't know if that'll come up in the book, but woof, the technology and expense of all this. Wow, oh, wow. Let's see. Notes to share before we get to audio segment two. I'll just say briefly, Lee Bailey being an expert with regards to the polygraph test. Toobin brings that up in the book that O.J. failed the polygraph examination. He does not add any of the defense's commentary that, hey, F. Lee Bailey, expert on polygraph examinations, you shouldn't even administer this test to Mr. Simpson. He's too closely involved. His ex-wife just passed away. His children are there. He's going to be responding emotionally. Should probably wait a while. And the fact that this test was only done because he was going to be going to prison imminently, and Mr. Shapiro hoped it would be better to test him before him going into greater confinement. But none of that gets matched up here. He continues about Bailey's penchant for drinking, that is well known. I think Robert Shapiro defended him in a drunk driving. I think that is the longest drunk driving case in U.S. history. I think it lasted like 2 weeks. Again, another illustration. If you're not the typical nigra, you are not going to get 2 weeks to sit around and ponder on a drunk driving dispute, not on your life. But the drinking, yeah, sobriety would be best. I think that idiot says that. Anyway. Let's see. Pat McKenna, as I said, should be on the program next week. Incidentally, he says McKenna found a chaotic scene at the O'Hare Plaza. Chicago cops, Los Angeles detectives, a swarm of reporters from around the world, not to mention agents from the United States Secret Service, who were preparing for an imminent visit by President Clinton to the hotel. I just thought that was important because O.J. Simpson has Pat McKenna, Mr. McNally. You got these two white men hoping that they can find, you know, some evidence to help exonerate you. Meanwhile, Marsha Clark, the prosecution, Gil Garcetti, they have the Chicago police. Remember, they're out looking for the knife. Los Angeles detectives, Van Natter and Lang, they flew to Chicago. That, where's that knife? We got to find it. We got to find it. A swarm of reporters, looky-loos listening, and the United States Secret Service. 1994, when this happened, they had the Soccer World Cup in Chicago. They said President Clinton was coming. That was why all that activity was there. They loaned them Secret Service agents, white dogs, to go out and search. We got to find that knife. Woof, woof. We got to find that knife. We got to find some evidence. Where are the buddy clothes? They had all of these enforcement resources marshaled for one person, Orenthal James, and still, even with all that, could not get a conviction. Next, let's see. They said witnesses reported that O.J. seemed in relatively good spirits. His demeanor seemed, it seemed, was not that of a killer. It was from tiny threads like this that McKenna and Bailey believed reasonable doubt could be knit. In my view, it was substantially more than tiny threads, because there was a lot of evidence of people talking to him both at the airport in L.A., then once he arrived in Chicago, about his demeanor both before he got the phone call about the killing of his wife and after,
that was pretty substantial, in my opinion. There was no one who testified, who said, who saw him in Chicago before the call or in L.A. Nobody said he was nervous. Nobody saw him bleeding. Nobody saw him with bloody clothes, looking nervous, paranoid, nothing. Chilling, happy, autographs, all of that. The people after the phone call, oh, depressed, anxious, distraught, what's going on? Total change in demeanor. So I think that's more than tiny threads, in my opinion. Let's see. I thought it was such a great line. They use a cow's word, in fact, to describe the vernacular and specific diction of F. Lee Bailey. Anachronistically, that was the way they described him. I said, oh, wow, that's a word. Things that are conspicuously out of place in terms of time and sequence. It would be the same thing if they were talking about the O.J. Simpson trial and said that somebody whipped out an iPhone. Like, that's, you know, they didn't have them back. The same type of thing. Out of place, time and sequence, anachronism, or anachronistically. That was the way they described F. Lee Bailey. But they said, in sum, Bailey wrote, the evidence in the case warrants a demeanor of controlled indignance. I thought that was such a great sentence. I would encourage you, keep that sentence in mind because it's so short and right to the point. A demeanor of controlled indignance. I think that is exactly what and I mean everybody. Incidentally, this chapter is called The Dream Team, and we heard the whole thing. It's no more chapter that we're moving on, new chapter. They didn't even give you all of the attorneys. Like, where is Barry Scheck at? He was like an MVP for the defense team. They didn't give you any information on him at all. Peter Neufeld, like Alan Dershowitz, where is any information? Like, it was just F. Lee Bailey, Robert Shapiro. Like, where are the rest of the folks who helped? Anyway, the demeanor of controlled indignance throughout the trial, particularly once the prosecution's case starts to fall apart. Let's see, anything else I need to get to before, let's see, Brother Bailey, I love that line in the book the line from Roosevelt Grier, minister and former football star, trying to repair things. I've looked into the situation and believe that Brother Bailey is innocent. We should give him a hug and make do. Let's see. And yes, the tackiness. This accusation comes up a lot. I think Tubin had already talked about this in terms of attorney client privilege. Johnny Cochran talks about this over and over in his book. I think we've mentioned it before, to have Robert Shapiro going out and saying, oh, yeah, he's guilty. Of course he did. Like, what in the world? He said he's innocent. Consistently, we heard that from Cochran's book. What are you doing? Oh, you want to make sure that you're cool with white people in L.A. Like, not trying to make sure I'm staying on Snoop Dogg's good side, right? Not trying to make sure that I'm in good with Dr. Dre. Hope he's doing well, brain aneurysm and all that. No, 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 no. I'm trying to make sure me and my white people out in Brentwood, this nigger did it. Pete, I'm just trying to get a little clean. He did it. He did it. Like, what in the world? Doesn't get any better than tacky. With that, we'll get to audio segment number two. If you have additional thoughts that you didn't get to share, make a note. We should have time to share once the second audio segment concludes. We're picking up on chapter 12, Jeffrey Tubin, The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson, audio segment two.
Chapter 12. A visit from Larry King. The decision, the last roadblock to opening statements in the Simpson trial, was the most important of Lancito's career. At one level, the issue was a simple one. Would the prosecution be allowed to present to the jury evidence of Simpson's history of physical and emotional harassment of his former wife? At another level, however, the domestic violence motion raised profound questions about the nature of criminal trials. Should any information about a defendant be kept from a jury, even if it is accurate? What evidence, if any, is too prejudicial to a defendant? If a husband abuses his wife, does that mean he is more likely to murder her? Does a defendant stand trial for what he did, or for who he is? On this and all issues raised in the Simpson case, Ito proceeded methodically. The judge came to work early, around 7 every morning when the traffic from his home in Pasadena was still light. The criminal courts building was mostly empty when he slipped into his chambers on the 9th floor, just across a battered linoleum hallway from his courtroom, which was known as Department 103. A window at one end of his long, narrow office looked out over the Los Angeles Times building and beyond, to the many towers of downtown. But the vista was obscured by piles of papers on the windowsill. Ito decorated in neo-workaholic style. Just 2 personal touches stood out from stacks of files and computer wires. A handsome, formal photographic portrait of Ito and his wife, Margaret York, who was one of the highest-ranking women in the Los Angeles Police Department, and a small stand of historic Japanese flags. As an adult, Ito had come to take his heritage seriously. A third-generation Californian, he grew up knowing that his mother and father had met in a Wyoming internment camp during the Second World War. Even Lance Allen Ito's name bore witness to the difficult days of the war. It honored a lawyer, Lance Smith, who helped protect the Ito family's property while they were interned, and a minister, Alan Hunter, who brought food and moral support to the inmates of the internment camp. Shortly before the camera on the wall of his courtroom came to life, around 9 o'clock, Ito would stroll from his office to his bench and check to see if the day's paperwork was in order. He wasn't wearing his robe then, so a pocket full of pens, his nerd pack, peeked out from the breast pocket of his shirt. When dressed in full judicial regalia, Ito tended to hunch over. His robe would blend into his black beard, giving him a soft, pudgy look. This was misleading. The 44-year-old judge was trim, almost wiry, and the veteran of a pair of marathons. In contrast to the adversaries before him, Judge Ito worked with very little assistance. A handful of students from local law schools rotated through his chambers over the course of the trial, but Ito did all the writing, and the deciding, alone. He had a fear, almost a phobia, of appearing unprepared on the bench, so he read all the cases the lawyers cited to him. This meant long hours of work after court sessions, either in his chambers or at his home, which was electronically linked to his office computer network. Ito, as much as anyone, understood the importance of the domestic violence issue to the prosecution's case. The prosecution had asked him to rule on 59 different alleged significant events or incidents of misconduct by the defendant, including Simpson's conviction in 1989 for beating Nicole, and Nicole's 911 call in 1993 when she begged for police assistance while O.J. bellowed at her in the background. Ito's decision would determine whether the prosecution's case would be a rather dry and technical one, based exclusively on circumstantial and scientific evidence, or a melodrama of increasing domestic violence ending in death. Ito agonized in a characteristically meticulous way. He asked the parties to make a chart for him, listing each incident, along with a thumbnail argument for why this evidence should be admitted or excluded. As he would several times in the case, Ito asked the lawyers to give him the information on a computer disk so that he could tinker with it himself. He read the cases, reread some of them, then began working his way through the domestic violence incidents, one by one. In order to avoid delaying the trial, Ito had to issue his decision by January 18th. Up to that point, he shared his conclusions with no one, or almost no one. The judge did tell Larry King how he was going to rule. Lance Ito was a paradoxical figure. Although he is a thoughtful jurist whose work reflects his earnest and rigorous approach, in the crucible of the Simpson trial, he displayed another facet of his character, too. Unfortunately, over the course of this long case, the less appealing side of Lance Ito came increasingly to the fore. Frequently during the trial, Ito behaved like just another celebrity-crazed resident of Los Angeles. But the problem went deeper than a simple case of starry eyes. Ito suffered, in the end, from an undue eagerness to please, an unwillingness to offend, and a fatal lack of gravitas. The outrageously inappropriate disclosure to King, which the talk show host, fortunately for Ito, kept to himself at the time, was only one symptom of Ito's affliction. His extraordinary interview with KCBS, which came about because Tricia Toyota's husband, an old friend of Ito's, had asked him to do it, was another. A third example came when Ito heard arguments about whether cameras should remain in the courtroom. At his core, Ito loved the attention that the cameras brought, and he never seriously entertained the possibility of exiling the viewing public from the trial. But the judge did love to tweak the news media. On the day the media lawyers were to appear before him, November 7th, Ito decided to play to the courtroom camera in his own way. The judge directed that 21 boxes of mail he had received urging him to ban cameras be stacked up beside the bench. A letter-writing campaign had been prompted by Chicago newspaper man Mike Royko. Noting the mail, Ito asked Kelly Sager, the lawyer representing the various news operations, "When you say you speak for the public or that the public has an interest in knowing this, the public has overwhelmingly told me that they want me to pull the plug. How do you respond to that?" Sager, who made regular and highly distinguished appearances before Ito throughout the trial, dismissed Ito's box-stacking stunt in a flash. "Certainly my clients would be happy to organize a letter-writing campaign if that were the way the court was to decide issues in this case," she said. "But I would urge the court not to make rulings based on public opinion. If 20,000 people wrote in and said, 'We think the DNA evidence should come in,' I'm sure the court would not then make a decision based on the fact that the public has spoken." Ito quickly retreated. The cameras stayed in place, and the stacked boxes joined the KCBS interview as symbols of Ito's naivete. First-time visitors to Ito's courtroom, who had previously seen it only on television, always said the same thing. "It's so small." The room was about the size of a tennis court, with only four rows of benches for spectators. In courtrooms, as in weddings, where you stand determines where you sit, so the prosecution and defense each marked its territory from the start of the case. Behind the prosecutors on the side of the courtroom near the jury box sat the victims' families. Ron Goldman's sister, Kim, came virtually every day, as did her stepmother, Patty. Ron's father, Fred, made it several times a week. The Browns came more sporadically, Nicole's mother, Juditha, most often, and three surviving sisters, Denise, Dominique, and Tanya, rarely. The press corps, sitting in their 25 tightly rationed seats, surrounded the victims' families. Behind the reporters stood three still photographers and a pair of technicians who ran the remote-controlled video camera on the wall. The defense side featured a similarly consistent cast: O.J.'s two sisters, Carmelito Durio and Shirley Baker, along with Shirley's husband, Ben, came every day. They passionately believed in Simpson's innocence, yet they treated those who didn't, including the victims' families and many of the reporters, with consummate grace. Ito kept four seats on the defense side for his own friends, and in the back row, a half dozen winners of the daily lottery for public seats took their places. That was it. About 50 people. It was the kind of place where newcomers were quickly noticed. And on January 14th, there was no way to miss the arrival of Larry King. Larry King Live was among the shows on which Faye Resnick had been scheduled to speak after the release of her book in October. And Ito had written to CNN, along with the other networks, asking that their interviews be postponed. Unlike Connie Chung's program at CBS, King's show had canceled the interview, and Ito had written him a note of thanks and invited King to drop by his chambers. It was a gracious gesture, but also one of a man who liked to have stars visit him. So, during the mid-morning break in court on the 14th, King, his senior executive producer, Wendy Walker Whitworth, and King's daughter, Kaya, were ushered into Ito's chambers. Ito was thrilled by King's presence and started rambling about the domestic violence decision he had to make. "I know Nicole's call to the shelter is powerful evidence," Ito told his stunned guests. "But it's hearsay. I can't let it in." The talk meandered for about 40 minutes on various topics: Ito's plans to work on the juvenile court someday, Kaya's coursework at American University, until King finally asked, "Don't you have to get back to court?" The break had been scheduled for only 15 minutes, so Ito found a fidgety group before him when he returned to the bench. Incredibly, King and his entourage followed him through the rear door into the well of the courtroom. O.J. rose in deference to the visiting celebrity and reached out to shake hands. The bailiffs, however, hustled the defendant back into his seat. Chastened, O.J. said to King, "Thanks for being so fair." Next, King moved to Robert Shapiro, who gave him a bear hug. Then King shook hands with Lee Bailey. All this attention to the defense camp disturbed Suzanne Childs, Gil Garcetti's peripatetic director of communications, and a future romantic interest of King's. Childs rushed from her seat to the defense table and steered King over to the prosecutors. "I watch you all the time," Marcia Clark told him. At this point, Wendy Walker Whitworth started to feel self-conscious about the commotion they had caused, and she hustled to leave. Unfortunately, she reached for the door to the holding cell where Simpson sat during breaks. A bailiff stopped her. "Most people try to stay out of there," he observed dryly. At last, King and his entourage, having worked the courtroom like the deck of a cruise ship, left through the spectator's door. Judge Ito had observed the whole scene with a serene smile. My own visit with the judge during the trial reflected the same puzzling longing for the favor of the well-known. Late one morning, early in the case, the Superior Court's Director of Public Affairs, Jerry Ann Hazlett, said that the judge wanted to meet me at lunchtime. The judge met with many reporters over the course of the trial, even though most judges in high-profile cases feel it is preferable to never so much as say hello to journalists. Hazlett took me back to Ito's chambers. Mostly, Ito and I made small talk: the weather, my decision to give up law for journalism, his passion for the flea market at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. At one point, I told him that I thought he had a very tough job in this case. Ito paused, then smiled. "Want to see something?" he asked me. "Sure," I said. "Want to see something great?" I did. Ito reached into his desk and pulled out an envelope that he cradled like a precious heirloom and handed it to me. I opened it and found a letter that the sender had thoughtfully backed with cardboard, suitable for framing. In the brief message, the author said he had been watching the Simpson case unfold on television, and he thought Ito was doing a terrific job under difficult circumstances. It was signed with a flourish, Arsenio Hall. I said it was a very nice letter. Ito beamed. The contradictions between the serious judge and the ditzy Angelino reflected Lance Ito's background. Of all the principals in the case, he was the only one born in Los Angeles, and he had deep roots there. The judge's grandfather had helped found the first interracial Methodist church in the city, and his father, James Ito, was raised in the solid middle class. James had graduated from college, started a truck farm on 27 acres in West Covina, and even joined the California National Guard when World War II began. As it would for so many Japanese Americans, the war turned James Ito's life upside down. He was ordered to resign from the Guard, sell his assets, and report to an internment camp, all within 2 weeks. Lance was born in 1950, and his parents, who eventually became school teachers, settled in the middle-class district of Silver Lake, near Dodger Stadium. James Ito had once harbored hopes for a more exalted career for himself, but the war dashed those dreams, and instead he focused his hopes on young Lance, who had an almost stereotypically all-American boyhood. He became president of the student body at a racially mixed John Marshall High School, and excelled in the Boy Scouts, earning the coveted Eagle Scout badge. His scoutmaster, a young lawyer named Delbert Wong, became a mentor and role model. Wong would go on to become one of the first Asian-American superior court judges in California. He was retired from the bench when Ito chose him as the special master to examine the contents of the mystery envelope in the Simpson case. Ito's teenage rebellions were modest, limited mostly to his refusal to take the Japanese language lessons his parents urged upon him. When he arrived at UCLA in 1968, he brought a first-rate mind and all the accoutrements of the good life in the Beach Boys era. A collection of Playboy centerfolds to decorate his room, a stereo system, an attractive girlfriend, and a Boss 302 Mustang with rear window slats, air intake on the hood, and chrome Magnum 500 wheels. He also had a less-than-reverential attitude toward the traumatic Japanese-American experience in the United States. Ito lived on campus in Sproul Hall, nicknamed Bacchus House after the god of wine, and on Pearl Harbor Day, the future judge would put on a battered leather aviator's helmet and an improvised cape and run through the halls yelling, "Banzai!" Still, the roots of a judicial career were in place. As a college student, Ito served as the director of student parking at UCLA, a crucial mediating assignment in a car-crazy city. Ito also excelled in his studies, graduating cum laude in political science and earning admission to the University of California's eminent law school, Bolt Hall, in Berkeley. After graduating from Bolt in 1975, Ito spent 2 years at a law firm and then became a deputy district attorney in Los Angeles. Ito's experience as a prosecutor shaped his judicial outlook. He specialized in cases against violent Los Angeles gangs, and he was eventually assigned to a special unit dedicated to trying these large and complex cases. As a fringe benefit of this kind of work, he first met his future wife, who was then a homicide detective, at a murder scene at 4 o'clock one morning. It was in 1983 and 1984, during the tenure of Robert Filibosian, one of the few Republicans to serve as Los Angeles district attorney in recent years, that Ito's career took off. According to Filibosian, Lance was a Democrat, and I was a Republican, but he was very sympathetic to the things we were trying to do in those days. One of the most important things Filibosian did after he left the DA's office was to help launch a revolution aimed at toppling the California Supreme Court, which at the time stood out as perhaps the most liberal court in the nation. Led by Chief Justice Rose E. Byrd and other appointees from Jerry Brown's 2 terms as governor, the 7-member court fought a long and rancorous war with prosecutors, which ended only when voters recalled Byrd and 2 colleagues in 1986, the fight Filibosian helped conduct. The court is now solidly conservative. Lance was not crazy about Rose Byrd. Perry Mochiaro, a law school classmate of Ito's who is still a friend, said, "His feelings about her were no different from any other prosecutors in the state." Ito didn't directly participate in the recall effort, but he made his feelings about the Byrd court unusually plain. His car in those days bore a license plate frame with the words, "California Supreme Court." The young prosecutor's vanity plate read, "In commentary, 7 bozos. In 1987, Filibosian recommended Ito to a fellow Republican, Governor George Duke Majan. The governor appointed Ito to the municipal court that year and to the Superior Court, where he remains, in 1989. Once elevated to the bench, Ito changed his license plate, but not, it seems, the sentiments behind it. One of the most important buzzwords used in the attack on Justice Byrd and other judicial liberals was truth. Ito would also use it in one of his early written rulings in the Simpson case. "The court must always remember this process is a search for truth," he wrote. The observation that a trial is a search for truth might sound axiomatic to non-lawyers, but the idea is in fact the subject of intense ideological warfare in the legal community. An approach based on truth cuts across the traditional battle lines between government and defense. The truth school, as it is sometimes known, asserts that the paramount value is protecting innocent defendants from being wrongly convicted. But it is not at all troubled by guilty defendants who are convicted, even if the police may have violated some provisions of the Constitution in collecting evidence against them. That, of course, is the rub. For more than a generation, the judicial system's remedy for improper police work has been to exclude the evidence gathered by these means, and therefore sometimes the guilty go free. Truth school adherents say that while they do not countenance unconstitutional action by the police, they believe that suppressing evidence is not necessarily the way to address such misbehavior. If the police violate someone's rights, they suggest, it might be better if that person sued the cops for money damages in a civil lawsuit, or alternatively, if the offending officers were administratively sanctioned for their violations of the Constitution. But in any criminal case, according to the Truth School, the jury should be able to hear all reliable evidence against the defendant, regardless of how the police behaved. As Akhil Reed Amar, a professor at Yale Law School and a leading Truth School adherent, puts it, criminal trials shouldn't be a sport or a game where judges just try to even the odds between the two sides. The point is that the jury should have all the facts available to it to make the right decision. When judges must decide whether or not to provide all available information to the jury about a defendant's prior record, say, Truth School adherents generally believe that jurors should hear it and draw their own conclusions. The day Lance Ito, selected to hear argument on the admissibility of evidence about the domestic violence incidents, January 11, 1995, turned out to be critical in the evolution of the Simpson case. It was the day he ordered the jury to report to a secret location, the Intercontinental Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, for sequestration. The jurors were now officially twiddling their thumbs with nothing to do. This personal imposition on these citizens, as well as the accompanying financial burden on the county's taxpayers, gave a new urgency to Ito's desire to get the trial started. Before January 11th, reporters and other spectators were allowed in the courtroom on a more or less first-come, first-served basis. But on this day, for the first time, the seats in the spectator section of Department 103 were marked with numbers, and the bailiffs admitted only those with passes for specific seats. Final preparations were nearly complete. A full complement of both victims' family members filled the seats. No one could mistake that the crucial moment had drawn near. The defendant showed the strain. O.J. Simpson has long been a compulsive talker. His friends knew that when they were speaking with O.J. on the telephone, they could safely put down the receiver for minutes at a time and return to a flowing monologue. No subject moved him to speak more than his relationship with Nicole. Visitors to Simpson in jail found him nearly obsessed by the subject. "Nicole wanted to get back together with me," O.J. would say over and over again. "I wanted to get away from her. How can they say I killed her because I wanted her back?" Simpson even talked a lot in the courtroom. Every judge allows lawyers and clients some leeway in communicating in court. But Simpson always seemed to intimidate Ito to a certain extent. And throughout the trial, the judge gave this defendant nearly free rein to jabber. This was never more true than on January 11th. As the lawyers dissected O.J. and Nicole's relationship, O.J. offered his own audible commentary as well. The defense was represented by Gerald Ullman. The slow-talking professor from Los Angeles had something of a tin ear for public relations, and he began by making a gesture that neither Cochran nor Shapiro would have attempted. Ullman asked that Judge Ito exclude from the courtroom members of the Brown family because they might be asked to testify about issues that would be discussed in court that day. In fact, Nicole's family had been exhaustively interviewed on this subject by police investigators. The defense had copies of all these reports. Ullman's request only invited the prosecutors to wave the banner of victims' rights. The Brown family, Christopher Darden said, have an interest in hearing the truth and learning the circumstances surrounding and leading to the death of their daughter and sister. Having already suffered the death of a daughter and sister at the hands of the defendant, I doubt that there is anything that will occur in this court today that can affect them any more than what has already happened. Ito agreed. The Browns stayed. The defense position on the domestic violence evidence was simple and well stated by Ullman at the outset. He quoted the prosecution brief, which had stated, "This is a domestic violence case involving murder, not a murder case involving domestic violence." Ullman responded, "By attaching that label, by saying this case is a domestic violence case, they seek to transform these proceedings from an inquiry into who killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman on June 12, 1994, into a general inquiry into the character of O.J. Simpson, in which he will be called upon to explain every aspect of his life for 17 years. And there is a fundamental problem with what the prosecution is trying to do here." The problem, Ullman said, quoting a well-known case, was that it is fundamental to American jurisprudence that a defendant must be tried for what he did, not for who he is. This was an unexceptional and entirely appropriate argument. But Ullman's ponderous manner and tony credentials hid a street fighter's soul. Ullman had his own label for this case. None of the traditional earmarks of a domestic violence or a relationship violence homicide are present here, he said. How many domestic violence cases involve multiple victims? How many involve the commission of a murder with the use of a knife? How many involve a complete silence preceding the murder, suggesting that the murder was committed by stealth rather than being preceded by any sort of violent confrontation or argument? In fact, if we had to put a label on this case based on these factors, the label we would put on it is that it bears all of the earmarks of a drug-related homicide, in which the frequency of multiple victims, the use of knives, the use of stealth, is much more frequent than it is in the case of domestic violence. As Ullman uttered the words, drug-related, there was an audible intake of breath in the courtroom. The suggestion was, and remains, preposterous, even on Ullman's own terms. First, by any theory, Nicole was the real target of the crime, and Ron Goldman just happened on the scene, and his murder was entirely consistent with jealous rage from Simpson. Second, Ullman was simply wrong about knives. Drug dealers overwhelmingly prefer guns. Finally, most domestic violence murders take place in or near homes, which means that frequently they are not overheard by others. Most important, neither Nicole nor Goldman had any ties to the drug world that would make them targets of a drug-related homicide. Ullman's suggestion, a real calumny on the graves of these two dead people, marked the beginning of a new phase in the defense strategy. The red herring of the drug hit theory was the kind of move most characteristic of F. Lee Bailey, who, seated at counsel table beside the podium, gave Ullman a wide smile at the sheer deviousness of his gesture. Ullman then proceeded to respond to the 59 domestic violence allegations one by one. He did so virtually in tandem with the defendant, who, seated between Shapiro and Cochran, provided a running commentary on each of the accusations against him. Shapiro also recorded in a memo Simpson's responses to all of the domestic violence allegations against him. The first incident was from 1977, when Simpson was alleged to have broken some picture frames during the course of a fight with Nicole. "She broke them," O.J. muttered to Cochran. Ullman moved quickly to one of the most important incidents, the fight at their home on January 1, 1989, after which O.J. pleaded no contest to battering Nicole. "With respect to this incident," Ullman told Judge Ito, "we have police reports, we have accounts in the form of letters of explanation written by the defendant himself, interviews, and a good deal of information about what actually took place. And what apparently took place was that at the conclusion of a New Year's celebration, in which both Mr. Simpson and Nicole Simpson had a lot to drink, they got into an argument in their bedroom. After the culmination of that argument was a physical assault, in which Mr. Simpson admitted that he slapped and punched Nicole Brown Simpson." Hearing this, O.J. nearly vaulted out of his chair. "I did not," he told Cochran, who patted him on the shoulder and urged him to calm down. Both in conversations with friends and in several interviews following his criminal trial, Simpson had a precise and narrow view of his misdeeds in that New Year's Day fight. In a deposition in the civil case against him, he said, "Never once did I ever hit her with my fist, ever. Never once have I ever slapped Nicole. As for what happened on that January day," he said, "I wrestled her. That means I had my hands on her and I was trying to force her out of my bedroom." A curious choice of pronouns, since she lived there too. "She fell when she was outside." Ullman's description of the event, that O.J. slapped and punched Nicole, thus conflicted with Simpson's own interpretation of it. The prosecution had alleged that O.J. also beat Nicole after a gay man kissed their son, Justin. In his memo on O.J.'s responses, Shapiro wrote, "O.J. says this took place in Hawaii with the entire Brown family. Nicole said to O.J., 'Lots of people think your daddy's gay.' O.J. got mad. Words were said, but there were no physical actions taken." The list of incidents went on. In 1993, after the divorce, Simpson hid in the bushes outside Nicole's front window on Gretna Green and watched her have oral sex with Keith Zlomzovich. O.J. to Cochran, "It was the sidewalk," i.e., he watched from a public place, not from among the bushes. After that incident, Simpson stared Nicole and Zlomzovich down at a restaurant in Brentwood. O.J., "I just said hello to her." He stalked Nicole and sometimes wore disguises. O.J., "Where does that come from?" In the middle of the afternoon, during the course of the argument, a lawyer representing the Sojourn Battered Women's Shelter in Santa Monica appeared in Ito's court and handed a thin envelope to the prosecutors. At the end of a long day in court, Lydia Bowden, one of the deputy district attorneys, disclosed the envelope's contents. "We have received information from Sojourn Shelter that on the date of June 7, 1994, Nicole Brown Simpson made a contact with Sojourn. She complained that she was being stalked. She was afraid. She felt confused. She didn't know what to do, and she named the defendant as the person who was stalking her." Again, many in the courtroom gasped. The date was just 5 days before the murder. On hearing the words, June the 7th, Cochran and Shapiro looked stricken. It was a sad moment. By any measure, Nicole Brown Simpson was a wealthy woman, even after her divorce. Yet at her time of greatest fear, with her life literally on the line, she apparently felt unable to turn to the police, to her friends, or even to her family. She had nowhere to go except a public battered women's shelter, the very charity that her husband was forced to contribute to after he beat her in 1989. And even Nicole's final appeal to Sojourn, the courtroom recognized at once, did not manage to save her life. For once, not even O.J. Simpson had anything to say. Ullman's opposite number on the prosecution team was Hank Goldberg, and he seemed, in some respects, a miniature version of the professor. Soft-spoken, with a paleness of skin and hair that seemed to render him nearly invisible at times, Goldberg gave the nearly perfect legal argument on the domestic violence evidence, especially for a judge like Ito, who had a predisposition toward the truth school. Goldberg began with a hypothetical question for Ito. Let's imagine that we tried the case, Your Honor, without telling the jury that Nicole Brown Simpson was ever married to the defendant, was just a woman who was murdered, Goldberg said. Ron Goldman was just a man that was murdered, and we did not tell them of the existence of any relationship at all. The proposal, Goldberg said, was self-evidently absurd. It's almost unimaginable because the jury would have to call into question all of our evidence, no matter how strong it was, pointing to the defendant as the murderer, because why on earth would Orenthal Simpson kill an entire stranger, just this woman named Nicole? Why would he have killed them so brutally? It wouldn't make any sense, and it would undermine the prosecution's case clearly. It is only when you understand the relationship, and you understand the jealousy, the possessiveness, that the killing and the brutality of the killing of Nicole makes sense. Ultimately, in a scholarly 10-page, single-spaced opinion issued on January 18, 1995, Ito allowed the prosecution to prove most, but not all, of the domestic violence incidents it wanted to introduce. The prosecution would be permitted to use the most powerful evidence, the 1989 beating, the 1993 call to 911, but not all of it. With some apparent regret, Ito excluded Nicole's call to Sojourn on June 7th. This was the part of the ruling the judge had shared with Larry King several days earlier. "To the man or woman on the street," Ito wrote, "the relevance and probative value of such evidence is both obvious and compelling, especially those statements made just before the homicide." But Ito correctly excluded Nicole's statement as inadmissible hearsay, as are all statements by a homicide victim expressing fear of the defendant, even on the very day of the homicide. Overall, Ito's domestic violence ruling amounted to a paradigmatic and admirable example of his truth-oriented judicial philosophy in action, as well as a buoyant send-off to the prosecution for opening statements. The judge's preference for truth in packaging extended even to nomenclature. As Ito stated in his opinion, Simpson's defense team had asked him to prohibit the prosecution from using such terms as battered wife, battered spouse, spousal abuse, stalker, and stalking because they are unduly prejudicial, inflammatory, and not supported by the evidence. Ito dealt with this argument quickly. On the basis of what he had seen of the prosecution's evidence, he noted dryly and chillingly, "Such restriction is not warranted."
Context of white supremacy. So we'll pick up next Thursday the chapter Blaming Faye. That's for next week. And again, just for scale, the trial has not begun, and we are a little bit beyond halfway in the book. Just today, with our segment today, we went a little bit over the halfway point. So we have quite a way to go, and the trial has not begun. Now, with what I just heard in the second portion of the audio, I'm adding to the list, Jeffrey Toobin is not being honest. Now, he said, "This is preposterous. Make these absurd claims. Ron Goldman, Nicole Brown Simpsons have no connections to the drug world." Is that what we heard yesterday when we had Steven Singular on the program, that none of these folks have any connections to the drug world? Really? That's what we heard? I'm going to go to the prosecution because I read Johnny Cochran for us, so I don't want to be biased. So let me go to the prosecution. This is Marsha Clark. Without a doubt, she's talking about she and Chris Darden, who was mentioned for the second time in the book today. She and Chris Darden talking about Faye Resnick. Remember her? So Marsha Clark writes, Chris and I both believed that Faye was telling the truth about Simpson's abuse of Nicole. He hit the trail and checked out various sources, all of whom ended up confirming her accounts. A nurse at the rehab clinic confirmed that Faye really had called the night of the murders. Incidentally, there are reports that Nicole Brown Simpson's children overheard Nicole having a telephone argument with someone approximately 9 p.m. We're talking maybe an hour or so before the murders. It is alleged that phone call may have been to Faye Resnick, and the record showed Faye Resnick did have a phone call with Nicole Brown Simpson from that payphone at the rehab clinic the night of the murders, and she had just moved out of her residence a few days before. So that's one there. Continuing, various members of the Brentwood crowd, Candace Garvey, Bruce, and Chris Jenner, also verified Faye's account of O.J. Simpson's obsessive, abusive relationship with his wife. Chris had several follow-up interviews with Faye. She flirted outrageously with him. Her pet name for him was Diarkaton. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Diarkaton. A musketeer? Go figure. She would leave 30 messages on his answering machine. Diarkaton, I need to speak with you. He'd play them for me when we got to work. Cowbell. Anyway, Chris liked her. He was all for putting her on the witness stand, but I held back. As I've said before, Faye had a very serious downside. There was her drug problem, for starters. So you mean that someone who had just been living in the very house when Nicole Brown Simpson had a drug problem so bad that they had to go to a rehab clinic just before the murders, but none of these folks have a connection to someone with a drug problem? Come on, Jeff Toobin, you're a liar and a public masturbator. Continuing, I held back. As I've said before, Faye had a very serious downside. There was her drug problem, for starters. On top of that, we'd heard that Robert Shapiro professed to have witnesses to an ongoing lesbian relationship between Faye and Nicole. These witnesses could supposedly describe the lovemaking positions both women had assumed during these encounters. Yikes. Moreover, while on her book tour, Faye had drawn fire from black women in the audience of national talk shows. To them, she was just one more white bitch trying to bring down O.J. Simpson. If the jury had it in for me, you can imagine how they'd respond to her. Well. Anywho, number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The last few notes from one of our investors, he wrote in chapter 12, Ito suffered in the end from undue eagerness to please, an unwillingness to offend, and a fatal lack of gravitas. Definition for lax gravitas: a person does not have the personal characteristics that command respect or evidence of leadership ability. Number two, Ito heard arguments whether cameras should remain in the courtroom. I thought it was a mistake to have cameras in the courtroom, but I was sure glad he did. Everything surrounding the case was a circus. I think the cameras just aggravated things. Number three, Larry King was among the shows on which Faye Resnick. Larry King is in the Hall of Fame of liars. One of his most notable ones is that he grew up with and was close friends with Sandy Koufax, L.A. Dodgers Hall of Fame pitcher, a complete fabrication, which he continued to state even years after being confronted with it publicly. Four, the future judge would put on a battered leather aviator's helmet, an improvised cape, and run through the halls yelling bonsai. Ito is one weird dude, a Japanese American mimicking a Japanese kamikaze suicide bomber. This behavior may be an attempt at seeking white validation. Victims. Number five, no self-respect. Number five, Ito Truth School asserts that the paramount value is protecting innocent defendants from being wrongly convicted, but is not at all troubled by guilty defendants who are convicted, even if the police may have violated some provisions of the Constitution in collecting evidence against them. This seems like a slippery slope towards justifying fabrication of evidence. I would tend to agree. Talk about that in the civil trial. Continuing, we have received information from Sojourn Shelter that on the date of June 7, 1994, Nicole Brown Simpson made contact with Sojourn, named the defendant as stalking. Now, this book is not about the civil trial. This information came out in the civil trial about this alleged call to the shelter, and I'm telling you from the transcript from the civil trial, that is also a lie. They had the person from the shelter come and give deposition. Nobody was named. They did not say it. It's even if this is Nicole, whomever made the call, nobody called that shelter that day and said Orenthal, OJ, the juice, or any other permutation is going to come and butcher. And I'm sorry, that didn't happen. It was ambiguous. There was no name. It was a celebrity. I'm just telling you, paraphrasing from the transcript. It was a celebrity. He's noteworthy. People would know him. He's well known. And I'm fearful, blah, blah, blah. There was no, oh yeah, it's this specific person. Let me get nothing like that at all. Lots more. Anyway, named the defendant as OJ. As stalking her, many in the courtroom gasped. Cochran and Shapiro looked stricken. With all the lies surrounding this case, what is the verification of this? Say that like 5, 10, 20 times. And again, the only reason that there's some scrutiny of this, why I'm saying that's a lie, no name was given, is because laws had to be changed to allow this evidence, put that in quotes, to come into the civil trial. That, oh yeah, there was this call to the ship. Master deceivers. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you dialed in, have thoughts, comments to share, especially if you didn't get to share the first time around, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I'll just say really quickly, when they talked about the battery cases and stuff, you know, as evidence, I'm not saying that they didn't have any altercations or anything, but battery can be something as simple as if you grab someone's arm and you hold it tight for a while and that person bruises easy, or by the time the police come, they see like a, you know, the handprint or something, they can consider that battery, but that's not something, you know, highly injurious. So there's no way of knowing what all these battery reports were, you know, but the, when you hear the word, oh, well, there's so many, you know, charges of battery, blah, blah, blah. And you don't know that it could be something simple like that. You think it's something always, you know, serious bodily injury and harm. So that's a mind game, I noticed. The other thing about the book, I don't know if it's anybody else that feels, you know, hears it, but to me it reads like a tabloid. The way he gives all this, it's like anecdotal information. It's relevant to the person that's being mentioned in that situation only because that's the person involved in the case, but it has nothing to do with the case per se. But then it's like some of the stuff, I don't know, it's like maybe I heard it wrong, but if in fact the judge let Larry King in the chambers and then gave him the brief on a decision he was about to make, something about that doesn't seem like that would fit, you know what I'm saying, court procedure. And if you witnessed that as a journalist, how didn't any of the attorneys for either side witness it, object to it, or file some type of motion or something? I, you know what I'm saying? I don't know about law through and through, but so it, either you contrive in this stuff and it's gossip, you know what I'm saying? And I can see how this would entertain people that like true crime with celebrities involved, particularly OJ. So it's like, I hear, you know, chronology somewhat, you know, like you said, there's some that's not fitting, but I hear the timeline and everything in general, but I'm hearing more sensationalism and controversy from, like, you know, from star journalism, like E! Tonight or Talk Soup. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, Irie. Very important points. Even that, I think Red talked about that yesterday. She got in before, but she mentioned that yesterday, and that label, true crime, in terms of how does a book or this whole genre, if it's a book or a TV program or whatever it is, how does something get, oh yeah, this is true crime? Like, if you have false information and you're making up stuff, if it's still true crime. And that is a super popular genre. That's, you know, Netflix. They got true crime documentary out of the yin yang to show and have people be all consumed with scintillating, gruesome murders. Ooh, hack someone up and throw them in the well. And matter of fact, I called Mr. Fuller to ask him about the Simpson case. And I said, do you think OJ could have done it? He said, maybe. I said, do you think Mark Furman planted the gun? Maybe. Said, you're sitting on the fence. that's what we got on the Fabi. Maybe it's all the way around. And he said, well, racists do encourage a lot of killing. Like he said, I'm never surprised about non-white people killing. They've made us into monsters and monstrosities. So, hey, that's not really a surprise for me at all about somebody going out and killing. But at the end of the day, even if you did do it, not saying he did, he said, even if you did do it, well, racists are still to blame. And he brought that up. He said that whole genre, I don't know if he said it was true crime, but the whole crime, did he say true crime? He might have said true crime. He said that whole genre of you go out and the whodunit and ooh, the murder mystery and hack somebody up and you got to over. Ooh, that's all of this is about for a whole year. We just get to be sit around and watch court TV and get to hear about, ooh, and maybe hacked her up. And like I said, the people wrote reviews of Jeffrey Toobin's book and it was, ooh, which one of Nicole Brown Simpson's sisters got a boob job? Ooh, how did they give us some more? Who is Larry King having sex with now? Ooh. That's the true crime genre. Did any other folks have comments here they wanted to get in? Grant, I'll make sure I get to my notes for the second audio section. So he mentions Margaret York, white woman that is a cowbell, the wife of Lance Ito, might again go to the white validation that we were talking about. Remember her name. Very important. There is a lot of deception and particularly enforcement officials who did not tell the truth in this case. Remember that name, Margaret York. Wow, gonna come up in a super dramatic way, way down the line. Next, let's see. Ito understood the domestic abuse. I think Irie was talking about that. What do we classify as domestic abuse? Because they're talking about significant events or incidents of misconduct. Like sometimes they're talking about an incident where it was yelling. Now, I'm not. I mean, you certainly can't be abusive, but. Oof, like, if you're going to say this person is a domestic abuser and a batterer, and a lot of these incidents, there is no physical violence. It's him yelling or whatever, or maybe he did some name calling. Not that any of that is correct behavior at all, but like,
wow, that's the motivation for this, for going and hacking up these people and almost decapitating the mother of your children in front, or not in front of, but in the residence where your children are sleeping. And it's that this person is an abuser because of them yelling at this person some years ago or what have you. And they're not, I mean, the evidence is a little lacking. At least that's just me. Let's see. Oh man, another one. We get a lot of background information. Sometimes he goes all into Johnny Cochran and these alleged affairs that he's having and all this. Like, sometimes we go really deep, right? F. Lee Bailey's alcoholism and all the rest of it. Marsha Clark, she stepped up against people who were making inappropriate sexual commentary or behaving inappropriate sexually on the job, just like Jeff Toobin. Patty Goldman, that's Ron's stepmother. Other gang mafia ties right there. That's an easy one that you can go and do a little research and see, oh, this might be another connection to the gang underworld right here with Ron Goldman's stepmother. Investigate if you have free time and or interest. Next. Let's see. This freaking Howard Stern talks about Larry King's visit to the courtroom. This is the early 95 visit that we just heard about. So he goes around and is meeting everybody, hey, blah, 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 and he goes to shake OJ's hand or whatever. And the bailiff hops on, oh, wait a minute. You can't be, you know, chatting it up with the defendant like that. Again, if this was Olden J. Sampson, no visit from Larry King, this would have been a plea deal, all the rest of it. Howard Stern flips out. I guess, one, Howard Stern does not like Larry King. Two, I think Larry King has the Rona. I just posted about that. He's supposed to be afflicted with COVID-19 and is in the hospital and all that. I said, man, we've been talking about Larry King all this time and he's in the hospital now. Anyway, so Larry King can't shake OJ's hand. They said the bailiff stepped in. Apparently, Larry King gives the fist, you know, like John Carlos and Tommy Smith. He gives the fist on, and Howard Stern loses it. He's like, what? I can't believe it. He's doing the black power symbol and this no good white killing O.J. Simpson. He's a murderer and Larry King is going to come in there. I can't. This is a total disgrace and a mockery. And they thought he was going to go try and give him a hug or whatever. I just listened to this yesterday. He had about a good 5-10 minute rant about this. Like, oh, this is so disgusting. How are we even treating him like this? This nigger killed her and blah, blah, blah. And he's going to get off. Look at this. Larry King is coming here to give him a high five. I think he says something to him. I don't think Toobin gives. I think he says that apparently or allegedly Larry King, he gives him the black fist, black power type thing. And he says something to him like, you know, stay courageous or whatever. This is, you can listen and hear what Howard Stern has to say, but he is furious about this whole visit. Continuing. And many, many people on the prosecution and defense side grouse lots about Lance Ito's conduct and playing to the media, the cameras, and all of that. Many, many people griped about this. Let's see. He mentions Judge Lance Ito excelling in the Boy Scouts and the Eagle Scouts. I would be remiss. We are only reading this book right now because of Jeffrey Toobin's Zoom bombing masturbation. The Boy Scouts right now in the midst of going bankrupt because of allegations of sexual misconduct and molesting young children. You keep seeing that pattern over and over. I said that Alan Dershowitz, those allegations and the thing with Jeffrey Epstein, all over. The sexual misconduct and particularly sexual misconduct aimed at young children all over. Continue. And then we go from that so this is Lance Ito's college upbringing. They say the Beach Boys era, he had his collection of Playboy center bowls, which is going to be certainly filled to the brim with naked white women. White validation to decorate his room, a stereo system, an attractive girlfriend, probably a white woman. How could it be anything else? He also had less than reverential attitudes towards traumatic Japanese American experience and all of that running around yelling bonsai. This is what happens when self-respect has been annihilated and you have been programmed to seek white acceptance and you relate to, you are identified with whites. I just want to be accepted by them. I don't see them as racist. Maybe I can marry a white woman, have white friends, even if that means I have to engage in self-deprecating behavior. There's lots of that amongst non-white people, even reminding me of the Oreo experience. Continuing. I just said that retired firefighter talked about the expense of this case. So they begin the sequestration of the jurors in January 1995, where they had been sitting around doing nothing. Now they start. Can't be watching TV and all the rest of it. So they're under guard by sheriffs, which will be the case for them until October. 10 months, longest jury sequestration in history. I said they start complaining about the money, and here it goes. This personal imposition on these citizens, as well as the accompanying financial burden on the county's taxpayers, gave a new urgency to Ito's desire to get the trial started. So, money mentioned for number one right there. Ooh-wee. It's going to be lots of griping about, wow, we are spending a whole lot of money wasting time with a rental James. Like, wow. Let's see. The seating in the courtroom, too, I'm glad he brought that up because it is known as a very small room. It's not like this was something where you could just show up early and maybe get a seat. Like, it was very small. Even there was journalists griping because it was assigned even for journalists. Some journalists got permanent seats in the courtroom, like a limited number. Dominic Dune and I think Jeffrey Toobin got a permanent seat, but it was very few. Most people did not get a permanent seat, and they rotated it out. So there was lots of griping because it just wasn't a whole lot of room to spectate. Let's see. Oh, my great. When he says every judge allows lawyers and clients some leeway in communicating in court, but Simpson always seemed to intimidate Ito to a certain extent throughout the trial. The judge gave this defendant nearly free rein to jabber. I thought quite interesting use of language all the way through. We'll have to keep that in mind as we go. Is O.J. Simpson intimidating Judge Lance Ito as we proceed with the trial? Do we think that's happening? Let's see. We did get a mention of Christopher Darden second time in the book, championing for the rights of the Brown family. And yeah, I took the passage where he says, where he's talking about Ullman's response about other theories, and it's possibly being drug related, where he says this was an unexceptional and entirely appropriate argument, but Ullman's ponderous manner and Tony credentials hit a street fighter soul. Ullman had his own label for this case. None of the traditional earmarks of domestic violence or relationship violence homicide are present here. He said, how many domestic violence cases involve multiple victims? Which I think is a great point. Did O.J. Simpson like decide, I'm going to kill Nicole Brown Simpson, former wife, go kill her, and then another person pops up spontaneously that I don't even plan that he's going to be here, and I'm so stealth and ready to roll that I can knife him, take him out too, and he's 20 years younger than I am, fit, good shape, can defend himself? Like, really? He continues, how many involve the commission of a murder with the use of a knife? How many involve a complete silence preceding the murder, suggesting that the murder was committed by stealth rather than being preceded by any sort of violent confrontation or argument? All, I think, are great points. In fact, if we had to put a label on this case based on these facts, the label would be put on it. The label we would put on it is that it bears all the earmarks of a drug-related homicide in which the frequency of multiple victims, the use of knives, the use of stealth is much more frequent than it is the case of domestic violence. Seems logical to me. Now, Toobin assails all of this and said this is, you know, preposterous that most drug crimes, they use firearms, not knives anyway. He says Nicole Brown was the target, even though Detective Lang was asked on the stand, do you think it's possible that the killers followed Ron Goldman to Nicole Brown Simpson's residence? And he said, yes, because I don't know. I don't have any evidence to the contrary. So that is possible. He continues, he says, finally, most domestic violence murders take place in or near homes, which means that frequently they are not overheard by others. Most important, neither Nicole nor Goldman had any ties to drug world that would make them targets of a drug-related homicide. That is not true. I've given you evidence to follow on both ends. Goldman's stepmother and then Faye Resnick was just right there. And even beyond all of that, these people were killed outside. I've seen no evidence that these folks were killed in the house and then dragged outside. So if that's the case, how did O.J. Simpson pull this off? Or really, how did anybody pull this off where nobody heard, ouch, that's my jugular, nothing? Like they said, the injuries that they sustained would not have precluded them from yelling out. People heard dog. People heard someone yelling, hey, 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 and all that. Nobody heard an ow. Stop. I'm being killed. How does that happen? How is OJ so stealth that he's able to muffle all that out? And they don't even get a yelp for help. Haven't had all of that explained to my satisfaction, especially if this is he's in a rage. I'm upset. I can't believe she's stepping out on me or whatever it is. I'm going to show her that type of thing. Like, really? He's angry and controlled and stealthy. Anyway, let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? They have the allegation that O.J. Simpson beat Nicole because a gay man kissed their son, but he didn't provide any background. No, nothing like that. Would just seemed odd to me. A gay person kisses our son and I beat you. Like, you'd have to give me more details so that I can understand it. He gives the response. OJ says this took place in Hawaii with the entire Brown family. Nicole said to OJ, lots of people think your daddy's gay. OJ got mad. Words were said, but there were no physical actions taken. That's what I mean. Like, if there was no altercation, I'm not saying you should curse at anybody or name call anyone. Am I supposed to process this event as, oh yeah, this is a batterer. This is an abuser who would sneak over and butcher and decapitate two people. Like, really? That's how I'm supposed to process this? Does that seem logical? We'll see. Let's see. Anything else? I thought just for Dr. Welsing's white genetic annihilation, Ullman's opposite number on the prosecution team was Hank Goldberg, and he seemed in some respects a miniature version of the professor, a soft-spoken with a paleness of skin and hair that seemed to render him nearly invisible at times. I thought that was quite telling. If folks have not seen what these people look like, Hank Goldberg and Mr. Ullman, you can look at their photos online. But there's a reason we have albino affairs regularly on the cows. Dr. Welsing, I'm sure, would have something to say about all of that. That will conclude my notes. Double check. We didn't miss anyone. Any of the folks with us have any comments they want to make sure they get in before we conclude?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes, I thought the history on the judge was interesting. Not surprising, but interesting. There was a multitude of Asians who are known as Japanese that were subjected to concentration camps. About 75 years ago, 75, almost 80 years ago. At the same time, when given an opportunity, they some of them joined the armed forces in this part of the world that's called the United States. Matter of fact, the military unit that had the most quote unquote hero honors was a Japanese unit in World War II. And became, you know, quite, I noticed he also became quite white identified, I guess as a strategy to advance himself, as opposed to the non-white Asian that actually was a part of the OAAU and was actually with Malcolm X when he was murdered. We talked about her, I think, years ago. I just can't think of her name. I was just thinking about her as opposed to Judge Ito and how different perspectives the two were. It's just shows you that non-white people would have different ideas and understandings, just like non-white black people do. Other non-white people have the same issues / problems or self-respect, I noticed. That's it. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. We will pick up next week. Faye Resnick, or Blaming Faye Resnick, actually is the chapter where we'll pick up at for next week. And we'll have Pat McKenna on the program next week, the investigator. We heard about him today, so we can get more details about the infighting that took place in the team. We can ask him about the drug connections to see what he thinks about all that. We can ask him about the alleged phone call that took place to this abuse center to see, you know, what he thinks about all of that. If he thought OJ did all this, we can get information about how he got the Furman tapes. That should be the middle of next week. I'll make sure to get the confirmation for the date and time. One of our listeners wrote in, they have lots of information online, as I was saying, about whether or not this alleged phone call took place, if Nicole really made it or not, interrogating fake evidence, maybe. Our person that wrote in was saying that many books about the O.J. Simpson case failed to mention that O.J. was hardly in L.A. In the weeks leading up to the murders. And they write, how could O.J. have stalked Nicole when he wasn't really around very much? And I mean, you can see even the day of the murders, he's leaving. You know, it's not even like he's hanging out here, like he was traveling. And I mean, many of the folks attested to that, that he's on the go, traveling here, traveling there, you know, restaurant. I think even some of the white women that he was engaged in sexual activity with would be some of their complaints, that you're not around. You're here. You're there. You're not, you know, just hanging out here in Brentwood doing whatever, kicking it. You're not even around. So, yeah, that would be important to bring out as well. But we will pick up here next week, a little over the halfway point now, and I'm about to get to the trial. I think by next week we will be in the trial, and then we'll be, bam, trial from here to the end of the book. So things should really pick up, get rolling. And Christopher Darden will actually now be a part of the story. I had been talking about him when we first started. This is a black male on the prosecution, but he really has been a non-factor for the first like 55% of the book or so. So I think he will become a major part of the narrative from now to the finish. Folks are good. Grant. We will be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Yuri Kochiyama, the name of the Asian female who worked with Malcolm X. Different perspectives. We're all victims and trying to deal with things, but yes, different folks have responded to, the pressure, terrorism of white supremacy. We'll be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We heard about F. Lee Bailey's drinking issues and such. Probably not going to have Robert Shapiro come in and defend you for 2 weeks to make sure you don't have anything bad happen to you if you get caught out drinking and driving. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, man, with all of the craziness that is happening right now, hunker down. This is for sure not the time to just be out and about cutting a fool. Hunker down for about 1,000,000,000 reasons. If you got to go out, you are super vigilant. Are they protesting? Are they being rowdy? Man, head on a swivel. If it looks like somebody is, you know, getting a little loud, getting a little rowdy about anything, no engagement. I have no time for verbal confrontations with strangers. You should be thinking, like, this person might have a whole trunk full of Molotov cocktails, firearms, who knows? Like, I did not leave my residence for Mortal Kombat. Not at all. I left the house to get water filters, you know, new tofu, apples, oranges. I did not leave to come out here and dodge bullets, scrap with a white person, non-white, none of that. No confrontations. You should be thinking this person could be armed. In fact, you should be thinking, like, ooh, this white woman might be armed. 3 or 4, 5, 10 of the other white people that she's with might also be armed. I'm out of here. I don't know if they're angry, disgruntled Trump supporters or whatever. I'm out of here. Whatever I came to do, we can do that at another time. Make sure you talk to your offspring. It is so dangerous right now. I feel like I've been saying that for a year right now, but it has been like a total year of just intense danger for anything. Toilet paper, corn dogs, water, just being outside. Like, man, be alert if you got to be out while you're getting things done, and then promptly get where you are going. If you're leaving, you're sober, you're buckled up, driver or passenger. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things that we can to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans, Amber Geigers of the known universe. And as I said, we really got to be paying attention. If you're out and about, it's not the best time to be texting or playing around on the phone. Do that at your leisure when you are safely inside. While you're out and about, man, I am paying attention what is happening around me, trying to make sure that I'm as safe as can be. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other victims of white supremacy, black people, non-white people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.